not hearing it in the.
What? In the PC?
So welcome, everybody. I'm aware we may be a few ISPs light, but I think it would be a good thing to start anyway. So this is the ICANN 61 meeting of the ISP and Connectivity Providers Constituency meeting. I think we'll just have a quick run around the table to introduce ourselves. We've got a pretty full agenda. And the good news is, although it's scheduled for over 3 hours, then there will be a break halfway through. I'm going to break the agenda to give everyone at least a comfort break as we work through. But to start with, I'm Tony Holmes. I'm the vice chair of this constituency. Our chair has not been in the best of health recently, Wolf Ulrich Noben. He will be joining us remotely. But I'm standing in to chair this meeting for Wolf for this time. So if we could work around the table, and if I could ask you to just introduce yourself, please.
Well, yes, Andy Pitts from British Telecom.
Jen Taylor-Hodges from BT as well.
Lars Steffen, I'm with ICO, the Internet Industry Association, and I remind you to state your name every time when you use the mic. Thank you very much.
Esteban Lescano from Cabase, Argentina.
Shinya Masaki from JPNIC.
My name's Mark McFadden. I'm from the Midwest Internet Cooperative Exchange.
Nicolas Fiumarelli from LACNIC. I am a fellow, first time ICANN.
Tomar Gavrychenko from Curator Labs, Czech Republic and Russia, also a fellow.
Thank you. Alain Miron, representing ETNO, the European Telecommunication Network Operators Association.
Philippe Foucault, I'm with Orange and Genesis Councillor.
Osvaldo Novoa from Antel Uruguay.
Thomas Rickert, Internet Industry Association, ICO.
Okay, particular welcome to the fellows who've joined us. Do we have a roving mic at all? Or if not, maybe we could just ask the people behind us to introduce yourselves. That would be helpful.
Ken Hansen with Farsight Security.
Thank you.
Jimmy, don't you want to sit at the table?
Come join us. We're not that.
We can see you're a member already. You've applied.
Okay, so whilst you're moving up, if I could go to the second row.
This is from Ethiopia.
Welcome.
Zizan Kabir from Bidikal, Bangladesh.
Thank you very much. And please, you may.
Jimmy Rodriguez from Cantu.
Thank you. Tony.
Tony Harris from Cabase in Argentina, and also GNSO Councillor.
Okay, so yes, just a reminder to introduce yourself when you take the mic. We certainly need to do that for the transcription. I think our chair will be joining us shortly, remotely. The agenda is on the screen, and I'm going to move swiftly on to the first item, which is something that's pretty fundamental and important to this constituency, universal acceptance. We have a number of ISPs who are engaged in that activity, and I'll ask Lars to spend 10 minutes or so bringing us up to date where we are with that activity. So, thank you.
Yeah, this is Lars for the record. Thank you, Tony, for giving me the opportunity to give you a brief update about the current work of the Universal Acceptance Steering Group. For those in the room who are not very familiar with the Universal Acceptance Steering Group, we are a working group created in 2015, and we work on that all valid domain names and email addresses are accepted by all internet-enabled devices, software, and systems. We had a full-day workshop on Saturday at this ICANN meeting for the USG, and just to give you a brief update, what we are currently working on. So we have a strong focus right now on EAI, on email address internationalization. So we are currently working on documentation that can be used by email software and service providers to give them guidance and a checklist how to become UA ready. Phase one will be that the systems will be able to send and receive email addresses that are based on UTF-8. And phase two will be that those service providers are able to host mailboxes also based on EAI. So to achieve this, they are currently working on some comprehensive documentation. So we have two sub-working groups. One is focused on EAI. The other one is focused on communications. And I'm one of the co-coordinators next to Christian Dawson of I2 Coalition, being one of the co-coordinators of the communications team. The next step that we are currently working on is to put together an evaluation of email software and service providers, just to have an overview of the market, which kind of software and services we have out there in active usage, and what is the current status of them with regards to be UA ready. The next step is, when we've accomplished this, to create a comprehensive outreach to those service and software providers. And one of the things that we are currently working on is also to have some EAI day. So like we had an IPv6 day, and for several other occasions, we have the plan to establish an EAI day to get this momentum growing and also rolling. Another thing in this context is linkification. So we understand linkification as the functionality when you type in email addresses or web addresses into software or in your mail client or in your chat client or Skype or whatever, that the system automatically detects, okay, this is a valid address, and it will create automatically a link. And we just did a review of several social media applications, for example, to see if this is implemented, yes or not. And the best system that we've seen is Telegram. So Telegram is very good at identifying email addresses and also links in several scripts, even in Arabic, which is not very common in software that we see nowadays. And we will publish this in the second quarter of this year. One of our target audiences next, in general, to that we address developers and CIOs, we want to focus more strongly on governmental CIOs, because from our experience throughout the last years is, when we talk to CIOs of companies, that we come very shortly to the question, okay, what's in for me becoming UA ready? So even in the Western Hemisphere, when you talk to people about becoming UA ready and implementing EAI, they say, okay, the traffic of EAI is very low in my systems. So what's in for me to take the effort implementing this? So when we target more strongly on governmental CIOs, it's not so much a commercial question. It's more about the question of how to do things right, and how to implement standards that are established. So in Germany, for example, there's a directive the government has to offer barrier-free online services. Of course, they didn't have UA readiness in mind, but this is something where I say, okay, this is where UA readiness can be a part of this directive, because when you offer online services as a government, and there are fields where you can put in email addresses, I think it's pretty fair to say, okay, you also have to accept email addresses that are not based on ASCII but also on UTF-8. It's just a question of being inclusive from my point of view. To drive more traffic to our content, we now established a few social media channels. So we opened up a Facebook page for the Universal Acceptance Steering Group. We set up a Twitter handle. We created a YouTube account to give everybody who would like to share the information that we are creating and the content that we are developing to make it as easy as possible to spread the word of universal acceptance. We didn't do that in the first place because we didn't have that much content, but since we started our work in 2015, we now have really a comprehensive library of several documents and blog posts, videos that we can share. And when you go to those sites, also please feel free to like them. I think it's pretty easy now just to share or retweet the information to make it as easy as possible to spread the word of universal acceptance. Another thing that we did is maybe some in the room know those stories from Ramon, who sent out FedEx mails when he encountered universal acceptance issues with .info many years ago. We did the same, and we sent 400 physical letters to CIOs of the Fortune 400 companies. And, well, the engagement that we created was 1%. So this is also one of the core and key learnings for us, that we still have to work hard on outreach to get the message through. This is why we established another thing. It's a UA ambassador program. So if you're already active working on spreading the word on universal acceptance, or you're already engaged, but maybe we don't have you on our agenda, feel free to apply, becoming one of the UA ambassadors. So we already onboarded three persons at this meeting, and it's an ongoing process, so feel free to apply anytime you like. The idea is to give them substantial support, so there will be funding for traveling and also to attend conferences when you get a speaking slot and things like that, to spread the word on universal acceptance. There's a document on our website, usg.tech, where you can see the requirements and what we'd like to know from you to apply to become UA ambassador. It's a great opportunity, I think. Feel free to take a closer look at it and apply. The next thing is that we established more local partnerships, especially in China and in India, because those are the regions where it makes most sense for software and service providers to become UA ready. And at the last MORG meeting, we also had a panel discussion to get more engaged with the email providers that are active at MORG, and also to address several security issues people might have with EAI. So for this, we had the workshop at this ICANN meeting on Saturday. We had a public forum yesterday, and we have several speaking slots in other constituencies as well to address several points. So yesterday, at Tech Day at the CCNSO, we had a very technical-focused presentation. We had one presentation also to the GAC to address that we would like to talk to the governmental CIOs to talk to them how they can implement UA readiness in their systems. And those two paths are now those that we have a strong focus on, EAI and the CIOs with an eye on the governmental CIOs, and those are the paths that we are currently working on. This is a brief update of the USG.
Thank you, Lars. Great job. I have a couple of questions, but I'll open up for other points first. Tony.
Yes, thanks, Lars, for this this good report. I have a question because at the Abu Dhabi meeting, there was somebody in the workshop, the UAE workshop, who was from India, and he was talking about an initiative from the Indian government to give every single inhabitant an email address with an IDN included. Is that progressing? Are there any technical impediments to that for them to do that? Because that's a story I think we should feature in our newsletter if it comes to be.
Thank you, Tony, for asking this. That's RJ, Dr. Data, from India. He's with XGen Plus, one of the email software providers. And yes, they did. And there's also... He just entered the room. Ajay, please feel free to come to the microphone. Yes, please. So this is first-hand information.
Yeah, why not? So thank you, and very important question. Yes, we have progressed in one of the states already. One of the states already, Ajay Data for record. We have already tied up with government of Rajasthan with 70 million users. This project has gone live on rajasthan.bharat, which is a Hindi domain, and every citizen has been given one free email address by government, hosted by government, served by government, completely free for life. Government of India is also contemplating. We actually already won the contract from them. This is under execution, and there are many projects like that is going to come from Government of India. Because of they want to do something on education separately, something for government of employees separately, something for citizens separately. So there is a big plan going on. And I think I'm missing secretary here. I just talked to him yesterday night that can you come over and announce him on remotely or something. I think he is going to do that in Panama. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Perfect.
Completely perfect.
Stay in the meeting if you like.
Thank you. Just a remark. I'm going to recirculate the attendance list because I know some people joined after. So if we could just go around the table and then around the back of the room, that would be appreciated. Other questions on universal acceptance? I have a couple of questions, Lars. I know you very much focus on elements of the community who need to understand universal acceptance and make sure that they're engaged in it. But are there really still, I don't know what metrics you've used, but are there certain areas of the world which in your view are still pretty dark on this? Are you targeting towards that at all as well as the technical elements?
Well, when it comes to which parts of the world are darker than others... to say it that way, as we see now in India, of course there are stronger initiatives where you have a stronger benefit from becoming UA ready. So when I talk to our members, for example, who are large email providers in Europe and in the US, and I ask them how much traffic do you have with EAI, they still say it's below 1% for them. So this is the reason why we very soon encounter the question, what's in for me becoming UA ready and taking the effort? So this is the reason why we need those strong examples, like in India, to give a good example that it's worth to become UA ready. And of course, in the Western Hemisphere, it's maybe more valuable to take the first step becoming UA ready in the sense that you accept new GTLDs, for example, because it's also still something we have to work on, that if you want to use an online service or subscribe at an online service and you use an email address that's based on new GTLD, that's still often rejected. So last year in 2017, we did a review of the top 1,000 websites, and we checked several test addresses from... short ASCII TLDs, long ASCII TLDs, several versions of mixed scripts, down to having full Arabic email addresses. And when you've got a short full ASCII email address with a short TLD, the acceptance rate is 92%. So this is the reason, because you might have a short TLD, but when the developer of the online service hard-coded a number of TLDs and you've got a short new gTLD, it's still rejected. So when you've got a long full ASCII email address, like .technology or .photography, the acceptance rate goes down to 78%. When you've got several mixed scripts ones, it goes down to 40 to 30%. And when you've got a full Arabic email address that's also written from right to left, the acceptance rate goes down to 8%.
Right. Yeah, still some challenges in there. You mentioned also having a specific day. Can you say a little more about thoughts around that? Because we've obviously had those ISP-focused days at various ISP meetings. Is your intention to hook it onto one of those, or is it something independent of that?
This is last for the record. This is something we still have to work on to create a plan. When it comes to the date, we planned this for 2019, so it's still some way ahead to have this date. But it's one of the projects we agreed upon at this meeting, that this is something we would like to work on. So this is something we have to create and have a plan and a path that we have to follow to achieve this goal to have an ENI day. So this is something where we probably will give updates at the next ICANN meetings.
Okay.
Can I add something?
Yes, please.
Small, 30 please. Seconds. I think one thing I must mention, Ajay Datta here for record. I am one of the large ISPs in India also. And I am saying this with a real example, that when we announced that we are supporting IDNs and we started bundling it with our connections as a hosted plan, the stickiness of the customer goes up. And in fact, the people who are forward-looking, who are technology-oriented, who wants to be updated, prefers the internet services from us. So this is one example and a low-hanging fruit. Before people take up this opportunity, this is for all the ISPs, this is something to look at to enable ourselves for EAI readiness and announce it for your own customers.
Okay, thank you. Lars, I'm sure on behalf of Wolf Ulrich that we would welcome having that dialogue about trying to help with that at future ICANN meetings. If that is in your thoughts, I'm sure it would be a positive response. Thank you. Okay, no more questions on that particular issue. Let's move on with our agenda. I'm aware we're running a little late already, but we started late, and I'm sure we'll recover from that as we go along. So the next item on the agenda is something called GDPR, which I think people may have heard of. And the reason it's on the agenda was that when Wolf Ulrich and I looked at this, we were aware there was going to be substantial discussion across this meeting. I think it's true to say that's happened. We've built this as further steps an ISPCP position. Now, there have been some pretty intense debates around this. We had the discussion in the ISP private meeting, and during that session, we were joined by Thomas, and we discussed the position that's been taken by the BC and the IPC, who both put in comments and were looking for us to basically join them with those comments. We had no consensus to join them with that particular set of comments they submitted. We did have some healthy discussions around that. But I'm going to open the floor up for views as to where this goes. There's a lot of open issues here, and certainly the CSG discussions this morning that we had with Euron, followed by the interchange we've had with the board, I think has highlighted some of the concerns that are around. And we have on the table, of course, the cookbook that is currently being discussed as a potential way forward. There's also the onus on everyone to speak with their GAC people, hug the GAC, I think it's been referred to a number of times, to try and make sure that the issues and feedback that we all require from the DPAs is forthcoming. I think a lot of us will have concerns as to the level of feedback that actually comes back. But at this stage, Thomas, maybe I should turn this over to you to get your take on where we currently are and your hopes for moving this forward. That would be helpful.
Thanks very much, Tony. Just one question. How much time do we have for this? And then I understand that I'm also supposed to update you on the CCWG accountability?
Yes, that's right. With this, I'm willing to allow at least 30 minutes on this because I think it's important. Hopefully okay. It won't take that amount of time, but let's try it and see.
So my suggestion would be to maybe briefly go through the current proposal that ICANN has put on the table. I'm not sure whether everyone is fully familiar with the parameters of this interim model. How does that sound?
That sounds good.
Great. So, Lars, if you could go to one of the next slides. There are two slides which actually outline the parameters. And one more. That's it. So what I suggest we do is we go through the individual components of the interim model, and I will offer a few comments on these points. So I can suggest that all registration data as currently collected will henceforth be collected even under the interim model. And that would include not only the data for the registrant, but also for the admin C, the billing C, and the tech C. And the problem with that is that ICANN does not offer any rationale for why this collection is required. And as you may or may not know, the GDPR has one of the principles enshrined in it, which is the principle of data minimization. So you're only supposed to collect as much data as you need to deliver a service or where you have another legal basis for collection and otherwise processing the data. So that's the biggest point of concern, because ICANN basically explains in the cookbook that this data shall be collected because we've always collected it, and it should be up to the community process to discuss what then ultimately in the long term should be collected. So we do think that there is an issue with collecting full thick data, and I should also say that according to what I hear from the data protection authorities, while they have not focused on data minimization too much in the last couple of years, now this is becoming more and more a point that they understand and that they are aware of. We know from some of the major registrars that the data they have on the registrant is identical with the other contacts in more than 90% of all cases. Right? So you don't get too much additional intelligence by collecting data for the admin C, the billing C, and the tech C. But where you do collect it, where the data elements are different, you are potentially getting additional issues because the admin C is not a party to the contract with the registrar. The tech C is not, and the billing C is not either. So according to the GDPR, you have information duties. And how do you fulfill those information duties if there are third parties involved in the registration?
Just to clarify, Thomas, Tony Holmes for the chair, for the record. As we work through, are you happy to take questions?
Sure.
As we go ahead.
Because
one of the things that I struggle with in this whole concept is trying to separate out the discussions in ICANN that should occur as part of the PDP, the RDS PDP, and the requirements of GDPR. Mm-hmm. And in my own mind, I need to make that distinction. And I think some of the comments you made probably apply to both of those, sometimes even more towards what I would view as the future work of the PDP rather than the whole issue of GDPR.
Yeah, I guess my take on it is we need to make sure that there is a compliance system by May 25, right? And whatever is required to be compliant is the new baseline for the community process, right? So if you look at the RDS PDP working group that's looking into these issues, they will not be able to go below what's required to do to become GDPR compliant. And I guess this very point is one where we need to work on now, i.e. following the data, the principle of data
minimization. But they could go above.
They could go above, certainly. But right. I think we need to make sure that we come up with a solution now that will hold water when it's tested in courts. Yes. Second point is... I will speak into whatever microphone you want me to speak into. So, the next point is transfer of data from the registrar to the registry. This is something where the contracted parties even don't have consensus on. Typically, what you would look into when it comes to this point is to see, to assess what data needs to travel from the registrar to the registry to perform the contract, for example. And if you look at VeriSign running.com, they don't know who the registrants are, right? So one might think that a registry does not necessarily need to know who the registrant is, but they might do with technical data who the registrar is, so that the registrar might be a sufficient source of information about the registrant. Now, there is the possibility to get that data travel from the registrar to the registry, based on a legitimate interest that can be claimed by the registry. So the registry can say, I want to validate who my customers are, or I want to run security checks to identify patterns of abusive behavior. And those can be legitimate interests for the registry to require the data to be transferred from the registrar. And ICANN seems to be inclined to require this transfer of data, which is possible, but to me it's sort of a strange concept to make it a provision enforceable by ICANN that a registry needs to have a certain legitimate interest, although they might not want to assert it. And we know that there are some registries, for example, who are not Privacy Shield certified, who say, well, we don't want that data. We're okay with the data to stay with the registrar. So that, I guess, is a point that deserves more discussion. But at least from the discussions that I had with registries, in total numbers, the majority of registries is okay with obtaining the data, and they even want to make use of it because they say, okay, if there are transfer disputes, it's good to have everything in one central place so that we can actually verify who the legitimate domain owner is. Then transfer of data to escrow agent, the full data shall be escrowed. For your information, that would apply both to data escrow for the registrar as well as for the registry, where you have different escrow agents. Then data retention, life of the registration plus 2 years, which is something that you can do, but ICANN is just saying this is in line with European data protection laws, and I'm not aware of any law that would support this notion, right? So we think that ICANN needs to put a little bit more flesh to the bones and explain why they have chosen registration plus 2 years.
Thomas, you're speaking on behalf of...
I've spoken to numerous legal counsels with registries and registrars, and we've discussed these points. So it's basically a group of contracted parties that have discussed these issues. So, and I guess this is... One additional point where we should continue to ask ICANN for more information. So it is possible to use 2 years, but then you need to explain why is it not 6 months? Why is it not 5 years? So you can say that, for example, within 2 years, most disputes are resolved, or that claims against registries and registrars are limited by statute after this period. And if you have that explanation, then you can put it into the contracts and make it enforceable, right? But in the absence of a legal rationale for why you chose this exact period, it's difficult to defend. The applicability has been a point of discussion. Do you want to ask a question? No. So basically, all the processors and controllers in the EU need to be compliant, even more so in the European Economic Area, they need to be compliant. And ICANN wants to make it possible for contracted parties to use their systems throughout the world. We've been discussing this in the closed session the other day, but there's a possibility to use one unique HUIS system for your global customer base. And that's a point that we agree with. Then ICANN does not require the contracted parties to make a distinction between natural persons and legal persons. And this is a point of ongoing confusion, I should say, because particularly the IPC, the BC, and other HUIS customers deny the fact that the names of legal persons can be personal data. And it is true that the GDPR only protects personal data, i.e., data of natural persons. And this you saw on, I'm not sure whether any of you have been in the public safety working group meeting this morning, but they also say GDPR only protects the data of natural persons. That is correct. But where the name of a legal entity allows for the identification of an individual, that name of a legal person is personally identifiable data and therefore protected under the GDPR. And therefore we need to be cautious. Some call this is over-compliance. I think it is the right level of compliance in order to protect the contracted parties from being sanctioned. Let's move to the next slide, please. Okay. Please. Sure.
Thank you, Foucault from Orange, for the record. On this particular point, I suspect that many, the comment would apply to others, but I suspect that this issue with having the name or personal data embedded in the legal entity label is not specific to who is, and you could probably have the same issue with the data you would process internally as an ISP or...
Correct.
So do we have elements as to how that issue is addressed for those other environments, other mean different from who is?
Now, I think the only advice that I can give is be cautious. You have a certain risk if you publicize the data of legal entities, because some of that data might be personally identifiable data. So if you have as an ISP have sole proprietors or small and medium-sized companies as your customers, in many cases, the company's names will include the name of the founder. You know, so you need to be cautious. And I think you can make a business decision as to whether you think that there is a big issue with that or not. And my take on it is, you know, you might have two points from which you are tackled. That might be the company itself or the individual behind the company and the authorities. And I think if somebody, you know, who is a small or medium-sized company, and they go after you for having treated the company data as corporate data, i.e. not as personal data, I think you can push back quite a bit and say, okay, we took what you gave us. You said you are a company. You said you are a corporation. Therefore, we truly believed in good faith that the data that you provided is not personal data. And I think in many cases you might get away with it, or even be, or at least your counterpart, the complainant, will not be entitled to damages because they made the mistake in the first place, right? It's something different when it comes to the authorities, because if you are sort of inviting wrong treatment of data that is personal data by designing your systems to potentially be flawed, knowing that you will get a lot of company data that will be personally identifiable data, I guess there is a risk that you will be sanctioned, right? So I think the risk is bigger with the authorities than it is with the complaining customers. I hope that answers the question.
Yes, sort of. Foucault again. I guess the question was also, was the element of risk assessed in those other environments? I, for one, I'm aware of many surnames being used as brand, being sold as brand sometimes, sometimes big names. So this does not seem to be specific to who is, I would think that us being late, somebody somewhere might have determined and have a legal basis for saying it's either one way or the other. I'm not a lawyer, but I would think that there might be other environments where this has been investigated.
I mean, you find a lot of clues that corporate data can be personal data in legal literature and in decisions, right? You find something on that in one of the latest GAC letters. They explicitly say that corporate data may constitute natural persons data. And also this paper by the International Working Group on Data Protection and Telecommunications, you know, the Berlin Group paper, that also states clearly that corporate data can be PII.
I think it is, Tony Holmes, for the record, I think it is a really vexed question because there are a number of different instances where this will come up. It's also probably going to vary as well from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And there are some cases where the whole thing will change as well. So maybe that just in some ways supports Thomas's view that that you need to be careful. I think making a hard decision on this is really tough. For instance, when we had the discussion earlier, Thomas, in the private session or the closed session, you made the point that your name was part of your business name. But there could be a scenario in the future where somebody wants to buy your company and they may want to keep your name because it has a reputation going with it that may enhance their commercial place in the marketplace.
That would be great.
But it shows you how the situation can change and then whether that's personal information is again, a difficult issue. So I think across the piece, this is a really difficult one.
Yes, and I think everyone who's representing companies around this table can take business decisions to take certain risks. The question is, do we want ICANN to dump on you in an enforceable fashion that you should be taking certain risks? And I think the answer is no. You know, corporate data in many cases will be data that is not protected under GDPR. But there is a huge number of cases where it is actually protected. And therefore, I think ICANN is spot on by not forcing the contracted parties to make the distinction between natural and legal persons. Okay, I think we need to speed up a little bit. So we have in this model a proposal by ICANN only to publicize limited data on the registrant address, so the registrant name will not be published, the street will not be published. They only ask for the publication of the province and country. So the city is not going to be published either, you know. But they still want to have some information in there that allows for a requestor to see, okay, roughly in what region is the registrant located. The email address shall not be publicized as well as the phone number or fax number. When it comes to the email address, they are asking for an anonymized email address to be published or a web form. And from what I hear from the DevOps, from the contracted parties, their preferred option would be a web form because even anonymized email addresses can be harvested if you know the zone files. And they can be spammed, you know, and that was one of the major concerns by the data protection authorities that you would be subject to bulk email marketing, right? So then ICANN is asking for a possibility for registrants to have their data publicized. They call it opt-in. Translating that to legal terms would be a consent-based publication of data. So there are individuals or companies that want their data to be publicized, and they shouldn't be kept away from doing that. So that is fine. And then next slide, please. Sure.
Yes, Andy Pitts for the record. You're saying there about the opting in. Is that still covered under GDPR? Does GDPR allow for that? You know, if a company says, yes, I want my data to be displayed, is that okay?
Legally, there is no such thing as opt-in in GDPR. It would be consent. So basically, and consent is a perfectly legitimate way of legitimizing data processing. So you can find that in Article 6.1a of the GDPR. The problem with this is that the consent must be given freely, and there must be no conditions to providing that consent. ICANN is today, in their contracts with the registrars, requiring the registrars to obtain the user's consent. But they're not doing that in a legal fashion, because they're telling the registrants, you consent to the global publication of your data, or you don't get a domain name. You know, and that doesn't work. But if it is the free, unconditional choice of the registrant to have his or her data publicized, that is possible. But the contracted parties and everyone in the ecosystem needs to acknowledge that consent can be withdrawn at any time without giving any reason. So, you know, you can't assume that this data that the registrant permits to be published will be publicized forever, so they can withdraw that consent. Okay, so let's move to the last slide, and that is probably the one of most interest, but with the least answers. And that is that the one before that. There has been some discussion about self-certification, because everyone is afraid that a gated access-based system will not be ready by May 25th. And probably it will not be ready by May 25th. So what's going to happen in the interim? And there were many who've asked for a system based on self-certification. The IPC and the BC are still pushing for that. And they've chosen the model of zone file access request for that. And ICANN has now acknowledged that they don't want to pursue the route of self-certification, because that's just too sloppy, let's say, too loose in terms of conditions to provide access to personal data. For the accreditation system, ICANN has the plan that they get the governments to work on that, that they get the Article 29 group to help them with this. And I think that this is going to be very challenging. You know, this morning I've asked at the GAC meeting whether the GAC can confirm that they're going to have something ready by May 25th. And they said, well, we haven't even started the discussion. And there are many government representatives that I spoke to who said that they don't really want to be in a position of determining who can get access to the data and who not. Beyond that, there are a lot of issues with providing bulk access to WHOIS data. So in my view, one needs to take a very nuanced approach to this and take a look at who is the requestor. Is it an IP holder, a trademark owner, for example? Is it a law enforcement? If it's law enforcement, is it domestic law enforcement? Is it European law enforcement? Is it law enforcement outside the EU? What about IT security companies? What about consumer protection agencies? They all might have different legitimate interests in requesting access to data. But do you want to give bulk access to everyone? Or shall they only have access to a limited set of data? Shall they have bulk access, or can they only file individual requests for data, let's say on a specific domain name? These are questions that are completely unanswered. And I think that ICANN's hope that the DPAs will fill in the blanks in the cookbook will be disappointed. I think that it will be on us, the community, to write something up and then propose it to the DPAs. Because at the moment, the cookbook is so patchy that it doesn't even allow for a proper legal assessment. So I think we need to step up, propose something. Let's stick with the example of the retention period. Say, okay, this is why we need duration of the registration plus 2 years. Does it sound right for you guys? And then they have something that they can take a look at. But just to say it's duration of the registration plus 2 years, tell us if that's okay. I guess nobody is in a position to answer that if they don't have all the facts surrounding it. So we need to put more flesh to the bones in order to make this a comprehensive proposal.
So, Tony Holmes, just on that point, I totally agree with you. I think that expecting the DPAs to come up with an answer, I just don't see that happening at all, particularly in the time frame that we have. And it's probably worth just mentioning, and I'm sure most people here are aware, that already, I think, in terms of accreditation, now there is some effort going in from the IPC and the BC to draft something. I haven't seen any of that. I don't know what's happening there, but just for the record, so everyone's aware, already there are parts of the community who are looking to try and do something. Where that goes and how it gets embraced in terms of the multi-stakeholder approach is, well, it just isn't clear at the moment, but there's just something underway.
I guess that's pretty much it. Okay. I guess in conclusion, I would say that we need to talk to our GAC representatives, as you know, I get to you in a moment, to ask them not only to provide us with their wish list. You know, the GAC has written a wish list as to what they want. The commission has said you should keep the who is as open as possible, but they don't explain how it can legally be done, right? And so we should ask them, don't only send us your wish list, also help us understand how we can make it work legally. And then we should prevent the GAC from becoming operational. You know, they have their clear advisory role in according to the bylaws. They should stick to that. And we need to be clear, and this is one of the biggest fears of the IPC and BC, that whatever interim model is adopted, that this will be just perpetuated. And we should be very clear that this is just an interim compliance solution and that we need to work on the bottom-up multi-stakeholder process to get this done through consensus policies, because that's ultimately where I can take its legitimacy from. You had a question.
Yes, thank you, Esteban Lescano, for the record. No, just how is the change of liabilities? So I can, as organization, can receive also a fine, for example, for the DPRs, or is just the register or the registry, and just to know that.
ICANN has not acknowledged its role. They are now saying that there are some sort of controller, but they don't say in what fashion. There is legal analysis as well as a letter from the Article 29 group that suggests that the registries, registrars, and ICANN could be joint controllers. And data controllers are subject to fines if something goes wrong. Now, what you need to understand is that you know, if, let's say, one registrar does something wrong, that doesn't mean that the DPA will fully sanction ICANN. So when it comes to sanctions, they look at who has done something wrong in the mix, right? So if ICANN has done something wrong, they will likely be sanctioned. If a registrar has failed to do things right, that registrar will be sanctioned. You know, so it's not like everyone will be equally sanctioned. But ICANN has made abundantly clear in the cookbook that they will come up with revised agreements exactly prescribing what needs to be done with the data, and that makes them a data controller in my assessment, right? So the one who controls what's to be done with data is typically the data controller. And the more ICANN dictates this, the more ICANN is on the hook for being a data controller.
Thanks, Thomas. One point you made that I think we can all coalesce behind is the fact that we should look on this as an interim arrangement, not just something that will be ongoing for perpetuity. So I think that's quite clear to all of us now. In terms of where we go from here, it very, very much is a case of let's see how this unfolds. But one final question to you before we change topics, Thomas. I mentioned that there's some effort going in from the IPC to BC to try and look at accreditation. Are you aware, and you have a much broader awareness of this area than many of us here, are you aware of any other efforts that are also taking place going down that path at the moment?
There's a lot of talk. I think Stephanie Perrin has mentioned during the cross-community session that she's considering an ISO certification-based approach for accreditation. I think that's more in the area of data security and that the data is in safe hands with you. So I don't know exactly how this can be operationalized. Then as far as the accreditation of law enforcement is concerned, there are discussions with Europol. So Europol does seem to have a system whereby they can assert that a certain organization is actually a legitimate law enforcement authority. So there are discussions in various places. And I think there's a huge benefit in using existing systems. You know, I think the IPC and WIPO have suggested that they could potentially help with the accreditation of IP attorneys. You know, so I think everyone is trying to be forthcoming with solutions.
Okay, thanks. Any final questions on this topic before we move on? Thank you very much. Appreciate that, Thomas, and appreciate your time at the earlier closed session as well. So let's move on. And again, we appreciate your help with this one, Thomas. This is looking at the accountability, progress on accountability. And originally, Malcolm Hutty was going to join us for this. Malcolm did provide some slides, which I think we have. And if we could, I hope I'm not taking you by total surprise here, Thomas, but if we could look to display those slides, Malcolm drew attention to a couple of particular issues. But also, Thomas, the floor is open to you. If there's any other elements that you think would be helpful to us, please just go ahead on that basis.
Yeah. Maybe last year, the accountability slides that I sent to you. So my name is Thomas Rickert. I'm one of the co-chairs of the CCWG Accountability. Hello, everyone. Changing hats, right? So we had a plenary session last Friday here in Puerto Rico, and we were quite successful in getting all the sub-teams' work packages approved. As you know, we had two work streams. Work stream one was done before the transition took place, and work stream two was dealing with 9 topics in total. That would be 8 topics, which we're going to see listed on one of the subsequent slides, and then one additional topic on the IRP, the independent review process. Lars, can you move slides? I'm not going to talk you through all of them. We're not... Okay, so these are the 8 areas where the sub-team reports have now been approved. We typically do that in 2 readings, right? So we go through the report twice. All of these 8 sub-team reports have gone through public comment. Those public comments have been analyzed, and now we have all the component parts for our final report ready. Next slide, please. So what we're going to do now is we're going to wrap up all the 9 subgroup reports, put them into one package, and they're going to be then put out for public comment. And the question is, what's going to happen once this is all approved? And we're going to discuss the approval process a little bit later during this presentation. But there were a lot of questions from the community as well as from the board, because Workstream 1 and 2 are quite different. For Workstream 1, we had to get things done, i.e. not only approved but also implemented, before the U.S. government would consider relinquishing its historical role with ICANN. So we needed to get the implementation done. For Workstream 2, we do not have a mandate as a cross-community working group to do the implementation, nor do we have budget. So our mission will likely end in Panama. And the question then was, what's going to happen with implementation? And the way this is going to happen, and we're going to have a discussion with the board on this tomorrow morning, but our suggestion is that the board comes up with an implementation plan for the Workstream 2 recommendations that will likely be produced by Joran's team, and that the board then consults with an implementation review team consisting of the co-chairs of the CCWG plus the rapporteurs that were responsible for the sub-teams to ensure that whatever implementation is done, that this is done in the spirit of the original CCWG recommendations, right? And this implementation plan, which I think could likely be a 3 to 5 year overall plan, because you can't do everything at a time, will then be discussed with the community for the community's approval and feedback, right? So that's the idea. So we're suggesting to set up an implementation oversight team in order to ensure that the recommendations of our work are going to be implemented in a correct fashion. Next slide, please. So I mentioned to you a little bit earlier that we have the sub-team reports ready, that we're going to put them together into one big report, and this report is going to be put out for public comment. And we invite you to take a look at the report and comment. But there's a big caveat. We don't want you to comment on the individual recommendations because all the sub-teams reports have been put out for public comment. So we will not accept any comments on the recommendations. We're just asking for feedback on potential inconsistencies between the individual work packages, right? Because you couldn't check consistency when you only saw the individual reports, right? And should you have ideas about what we should have done differently on human rights or transparency or diversity, we will not change our recommendations, but we will archive that input. And that can then be used by ATRT or other reviews dealing with accountability, right? So if you see the announcement for public comment next in the middle of this month, roughly, only comment on inconsistencies. Next slide, please.
Just a quick question, Thomas, to make sure I understood that right. Could you just say again how the makeup of the implementation oversight team is going to be?
Yes, we had so-called rapporteurs that were in charge of leading the subcommittees. So let's say there was one rapporteur or two rapporteurs for transparency, one for diversity, one for human rights. So they all had leaders for the sub-teams. And since these leaders have been guiding the genesis of the recommendations in the sub-teams, they are subject matter experts. And we want to have the implementation oversight team consisting of those rapporteurs plus the co-chairs of the CCWG. Does that make sense?
It does. I was just wondering whether there was any thought to having any additional independence within that group. That was the only issue.
Yeah, I guess, this team will already have 20 people or so, because for many of the sub-teams we had two rapporteurs, and we didn't want to make it too big, and we wanted to make sure that you could certainly do a call for proposals for people that want to be part of that team, but the CCWG has discussed this in its plenary and they've agreed that the rapporteurs and the co-chairs should be it. Okay, next slide, please. We're going to skip all that, Lars. So, because that's a summary of the recommendations, you know all this. So please scroll down further.
I will say for other people here, we will circulate these slides as well. So if you don't get the chance to read them, catch up. You will get that opportunity.
So those are just summaries of the recommendations. That's not for now. Okay. So we will launch the public comment period. After the public comment period closes, we will make final adjustments where necessary, and we plan to send the finalized report that has been adopted by the CCWG plenary to the chartering organizations well before Panama. And we would hope that the chartering organizations take a look at the report and potentially approve it during the Panama meeting. Question is that going to be realistic? But we do know that, for example, the CCNSO is considering to get that done during the Panama meeting. So that would be great. And once all the chartering organizations have approved the report, it will be sent to the board. So next and last slide, Lars, that's a visualization of the approval process. So we're basically, we have all the sub-team reports that have gone for public comment. That's done. We're now in the left middle section, right? And then we're going to send our report out for public comment. That's the second globe or earth visualization in the middle. We will then finalize our report. Then the chartering organizations are going to hopefully approve in Panama. And then it's going to be submitted to the board, and hopefully the board will then approve our recommendations. And I should say that the hurdles for the board to reject our recommendations are quite high. They can only reject it if they think that our recommendations are not in the global public interest. So that's it. And if we succeeded in doing that, we're going to disband. And, you know, it was like done in no time.
And the champagne, right?
We've asked, despite all the budget cuts, for ICANN to throw a big party for this group.
I have a question about, and this is just, I don't know. Has any other approval process involved the chartering organizations? The reason I ask is because I've seen other parts now, not the CCNOs, not the GNSO. I completely trust them to get the work done. But, for instance, I was just in an ASO meeting today, and I also had an experience this week with RSAC. If you're optimistic about the chartering organizations actually approving things expeditiously, I'm not throwing cold water on that. I'm just wondering, have we been through, I don't know that we've been through this yet, where we have the, before handing it to the board, we hand it to the chartering organizations.
Now, we've gone through that in Workstream 1. And, for example, the GAC has just remained silent on it. You know, so they didn't object, and that was good enough.
Okay, thanks for that. That's just what I needed to know. So, that for instance, if a chartering organization takes a certain amount of time and doesn't respond, that's considered assent.
And RSEC and ESSEC are not chartering organizations.
Yeah.
You know, so... I think that, I don't envisage any of the chartering organizations to establish roadblocks for finishing our work.
Okay, thanks, Thomas. We just need another week on the Panama meeting, I think, because with a strategic plan and all of this going on for a policy meeting, wow, that's a really tough schedule. But certainly to everyone involved in this, it's been a tremendous feat to get this far. We should all congratulate you and thank you for that. Lars, there was also the other set of slides from Malcolm. Maybe we can just, I'm aware other people are here to take their slots, but whilst Thomas is with us, if we could just quickly walk through those as well. There was just a couple of issues that Malcolm wanted to flag out of that to people. I'm sure you're well-versed in that, Thomas, as well.
I'm not so sure.
As it comes up, I...
Because we...
Yes.
Maybe we just leave that for everyone to read?
Well, let's just... People do need to read them, but if you have any comments...
Because in fairness, we had... you know, each of the co-chairs has been allocated with certain sub-teams, and I'm not an expert on this one.
Okay.
You know, so
if it's unfair to do that, then we can certainly...
It's not unfair to ask me, but I can be only of limited help.
Sure. Okay. Well, we'll just spend a few moments on that quickly, and then I'm sure any questions, Malcolm will be ready to pick up. And we can always get it added as an item on our next call as well. If you're struggling with it, then I'll, because of the... Okay, they did go to Andrew, but...
I've got them as a PowerPoint.
Yep, but... I see, I get it, okay. Okay, then what we'll do, we'll make sure that they go to the list and I'll ask Wolf Ulrich, I think, is with us. I'll ask Wolf Ulrich to make a slot on our next scheduled call.
I can show them on the screen, and then they're not in the Adobe Connect.
I think that would be acceptable for a couple of minutes. We're only going to spend a couple of minutes on it, so if you could do that. And then Thomas can say one. I haven't even looked at those. So, but we'll just give it a couple of minutes. I noticed that whilst we're doing that, Chris, I noticed you're with us. You're okay for time with us. Okay, thanks.
I think the best I can do is read those slides for you because I don't even know what's on them. You know, it's like 12 slides or so.
Okay. Easy way. We'll do that as a separate exercise. So it's unfortunate Malcolm is unable to be here now. We'll make sure that we draw attention to these. We'll do that on our call. So we can move on with the agenda if that's the case. It's probably the easiest way. So with that, thank you, Thomas. Really appreciate
thanks very much for having me.
Support. Thank you.
My pleasure, as always.
You're always welcome here. You know that. Thank you. Okay, so is Matt here? Matt Larson?
I'm here.
Ah, great. Matt, if you'd like to come and join us.
I emailed them to Tony, who forwarded them, or someone.
To.
Oh, okay. Whom should I mail them to?
From Andrea. Oh, okay.
Whom should I mail them to?
So that's LARSSTEFFEN.
Okay, one moment, please.
That's good. Oh, here, let me go for it. Last.steffen@ecoecos.de. Perfect, thank you.
Okay, so whilst Lars is getting the slides ready, maybe I can hand over to you, Matt, and you can get us started. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks for the chance to talk to you this afternoon. I don't know how familiar everyone is with DNSSEC and with the Root KSK rollover project. I'll try to be brief, and I have some slides that describe where we are at this point in the project. But as you may be aware, ICANN runs this incredibly important cryptographic key for DNSSEC. It's never been changed, and we were going to change it or roll it for the first time last October. We got some information that led us to believe people weren't as ready as we thought or hoped they might be, and we decided to postpone while we analyzed that information. And this information that I'm talking about was a relatively recent change to the DNS protocol that very, very modern DNS resolvers implement, that when they're configured to do DNSSEC, they can report back which key signing keys, which trust anchors, which keys they're using, and they report these to the root servers. So for the most modern DNS resolvers, we have an idea of what keys they have configured. It turns out this isn't as good a signal as we thought it would be, because this tells us what key a resolver is using, but gives us no indication who's using that resolver. It could be in somebody's basement with nobody using it. It could be a resolver that has tens of thousands of people using it. So it's unfortunately not a terribly good signal, but it's the data we have, and we made an attempt to understand it. And so that where we last left it when we postponed the KSK roll in last fall was we said, all right, we're going to go away and try to figure out try to understand this data more, because what we were seeing was around 7 or 8% of those reporting, which was a very small number, like literally single-digit thousands of resolvers were reporting this data. And so a handful, 7 to 8%, said they're not ready. They don't have the new key. And so we made an attempt to figure that out, to actually contact a list of about 500 IP addresses. And that turns out to be very difficult. And about 80% of those people, we either couldn't contact them or they didn't want to talk to us. And of the remaining, most of them were in dynamic address space. So these would be virtual machines or Docker containers or things like that. The upshot here is that we didn't get any single cause. We were hoping that there would be one or two things that we could adjust our messaging, perhaps go to vendors to get bugs fixed. But instead, we were left without a whole lot more understanding than when we started. So near the end of last year then, what the ICANN org decided to do was ask the community for their suggestions for how to proceed. And we said, let's do this on an existing mailing list we have where we discussed the KSK rollover project. We did that. The feedback we got was, well, you should, ICANN should proceed with the roll and keep talking to people. And we're not sure what you could measure to be sure if people are ready or not, what to use as acceptable criteria. But, you know, steady as she goes, onward, roll the key. So based on that, we created a draft plan that we published on February 1st. And that plan calls for rolling the KSK exactly a year later. Let's see. Great. Could you forward a few slides, please? Keep going, please. I think slide 6. Yes, thank you. So on February 1st, then, we published this draft plan. And that calls for rolling the key on October 11th, 2018, so exactly 1 year delayed. And we also at the same time opened a public comment. And this is actually a draft plan because we want to get the community's input in this public comment to hear how they think we should proceed. So you can see the timetable that we have scheduled up here. We hope to get community feedback, revise the plan, hear from SAC. I don't have it on the slide, but we're going to ask RSAC as well. And if the plan does not change based on the feedback, then you'd see how the cadence of events takes us to rolling the key on October 11th. And the reason I'm here today is that since we've been collecting this data of resolvers reporting what trust anchors they have configured, we've only seen more and more and more resolvers report. Could I ask you to go forward, please, to the graph? Keep going, please. There we go. So this graph is potentially a little confusing because there's two things shown on here. The green and the red are numbers of resolvers, and you should read the scale on the left. So you can see the dramatic increase we had. The green would be the total number of resolvers reporting, and this is unique resolvers per day. So you can see it's kind of hard to read, but the green sort of is topping off around 50,000. So every day around 50,000 different IP addresses are phoning home to the various root servers and saying, these are the trust anchors I have configured for DNSSEC. So that's the green line. And then the red line is the number of those who are saying, and I have the old key, I am not ready for the KSK rollover. And then if you do the division of red over red plus green, you get the percentage that are not ready. And that's what I've plotted in black. And the scale to read for that is on the right. So red and green are numbers of sources, and black is a percentage. So if you look at that, you look at that line, that is at about 20 to 25%. So as of right now, there are about 20% of those reporting on a daily basis saying they're not ready. So that's worse than when we started started looking at this data in the fall. Could I ask you to advance a few more slides, please? Keep going, please. That one, yes. All right. So this is the same scales in that we're still showing green and red are numbers of sources. But now rather than unique sources per day, these are cumulative unique sources. So this is over time. This is showing how many IPs we've heard from. So if you look at where that green one tops out, now we're looking at over 700,000 unique IPs. So in the time we've been paying attention to this, over 700,000, I think the actual number is about 730,000 different IPs have reported to us. And if you look at the red line, it's around 250,000, excuse me, around 250,000 unique IPs over time have said that they have the old key. And if you do the math on that, that's the black line. That's even worse. That's more like a third, like 33%. So we have this data. It's my belief, and we're still analyzing it. It's my belief that a lot of these are ephemeral instances. They're virtual machines or Docker containers that are in dynamic address space. They come up. They have a configuration that has the old key. They report the old key. They do what they need to do. They're torn down, and then they come up again somewhere else and report, which would explain why the cumulative number is so much larger than the daily number. And as I said, this data is unfortunate because it only tells us about resolvers, not about users, and it's users that we really care about, how they're affected. You know, I don't care if a machine as I said, in somebody's basement, has the old key if nobody's paying any attention to it and using it. Nevertheless, as bad as the signal in this data might be, we still have the data, and I think we would be remiss if we didn't try to analyze it further and understand it further and remediate further. And so that's what brings me here today, which is to ask for support and help from the ISPCP to help us track down these IP addresses. And I realize the audacity of coming to you saying that, well, I have a quarter of a million IP addresses that are reporting the wrong thing. Can you help me find them? I understand that's a tall order. I do have permission from ICANN's legal department to publish the list. And so I haven't done that yet, but I'm going to publish it ordered by source ASN. So somebody will be able to, you know, look up their AS and see all the IPs in that they're advertising in their space that are reporting the old key. So we can at least make it so that an ISP doesn't have to sort through all the chaff to find the wheat for them. I completely understand that it's a difficult task. I do have some documentation that would describe what to look for. In other words, if you contact somebody, once an operator is contacted, we have some material to give them to say, well, here's what you're looking for, and then here's what you need to do. But it's my hope that the ISPCP membership would have better resources to track these down. So there's two points, two purposes in tracking these down. One would be to, of course, get them changed. That if it indeed is a resolver that has the old key, then we'd like it to get it updated so that it's ready for the KSK role. And then the second would be to just understand why it had the old key. You know, if it turns out that it is a Docker container that has an old config and is hopping around from address to address, well, then that's good to know. That would validate our theory that these are dynamic addresses. So that's how I come to you today with a request for help, and I admit sort of a difficult request, but any help that you would be able to provide would be gratefully received, and I'd be happy to. I know that's a lot of information, talking very quickly in a short period of time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thanks, Matt. I mean, you can certainly ask, and we will certainly try and help all we can. And you can imagine in this particular community there's an air of unease about the whole thing, quite understandably so. We had some discussion about this in our closed session as well. As Mark referred to it as the difficulty trying to become unpregnant, I think he said at the time, which was a rather unique analogy.
I'd like to take that back.
It's not on the transcript.
It is now. but it is a difficult situation, and one of the questions I have for you is you obviously come to us and we can have some discussion and we can certainly get some information out to our members, but what other efforts are you taking to obtain that information? I mean, I assume you're talking with the RIRs and other people like that, is that true?
We are talking with the RIRs, and we're continuing our outreach to the technical community, just getting to events, any place where we think there would be people who would be resolver operators. We, as a matter of course, we hit all the RIR meetings every year. We hit operational forums like NANOG and regional NOGs. There's some fatigue setting in at this. In fact, it's not setting in. It has set in. At this point, we're getting rejected for talks, right? People don't want to hear from us anymore. They're tired of hearing about it. So that's a battle that we're now fighting that we didn't fight earlier on.
Wow, that's an interesting remark, particularly when you look at the way the increase has suddenly occurred in terms of more information that's been out there, more research, better data.
Well, we haven't been rejected since. These I've put together relatively recently. It'd be interesting to see if we start showing even more dramatic, terrifying numbers, if we'd maybe get more interest again.
Often the way to unlock it. Mark?
Thanks for this, Matt. This is really helpful, really interesting information, and my palms are sweaty. I was talking to David today, and I said, I can't believe we're going ahead with a rollover with this kind of data in our face, right? And knowing that we have to know more about that data. I'll come back to that in a second. But I actually really appreciate this. I do have one question about it, and is, am I understanding this correctly that this is all data from just one root?
No, it's actually, we've added root servers over time. At this point, we're getting data. This represents data from 11 of the 13 root servers, yeah. But it is one of the things I should stress, and this is unfortunately easily lost in the message, is that the thing to remember is, even though we're talking about, depending on your definition of large, relatively large numbers, hundreds of thousands, this is only the very latest software, resolver software, that supports this, right? So there are, you know, when you look at the total number of unique sources that hit authoritative servers, it's tens of millions. All kinds of things send DNS queries. So this is only a very small portion.
If I understand this right, the current version of Bind doesn't support this.
The very latest does.
The very latest
version of Bind, the last couple of versions of Unbound. But, of course, there are multiple streams of Bind. And, of course, we know the tail of DNS software is incredibly long.
Right.
So there's definitely much, much more software on the Internet that does not report its trust anchor configuration than there is that does.
Right. And let me ask you, and so I'm sure that ISPs for modulo their ability would be happy to help here in terms of looking. And of course, talking to the RIR seems essential. It seems essential to me on the face of it. One of the interesting things you said was about the VMs and the containers. And I'm wondering, and I'm sure the answer is yes here, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. You know, are you going to the Amazons and talking to the AWS people and going to Google and saying, hey, as people are spinning up containers, what are you giving them prepackaged implementations that have this old key in it?
Yeah, that's on the long to-do list we have of things to follow up on, but we haven't done that.
The two things that I'm really interested in this data is how much is hidden from our view in private networks, right? And then, and of course, the old software one, which we already talked about. But I think the container one is probably a good guess. But I would like to have AWS, I would like to have those folks actually confirm or deny that, or it's something you could experiment with a modest amount of money, say $100. You could actually spin up some containers of your own for a set of 10 cloud providers and see what you get, right? And see what you get as the default package. I don't know, and I should know because I'm an AWS customer, but I think that in terms of research, that's something that could possibly be done by someone in a day just to spend $100.
Tamar Gorychenko from Curator Lab, sorry. One thing which is important in that regard is that in numerous cloud providers, Amazon being not the single one among them, it's not only Amazon who creates templates for containers, but users as well. So this peak could be as well some kind of, I guess, Amazon customer sharing a template of a container for Bitcoin mining or something. Maybe that.
Right. You know, in my limited experience with the personal stuff I've done, you know, if I spin up a VM at Linode, for example, where I have some stuff, by default, that uses Linode's own recursive servers. So I tend to think that these are, as you suggest, something else that somebody's created and they've decided, like, oh, I want my own resolver for whatever reason, and they just happen to get the old KSK. I'd love to have a smoking gun. You know, I'd love to find that, but we haven't as of yet.
Lars?
Yeah, this is Lars for the record. I can't speak for Christian because he's not here, but I think this is a typical task for trade associations within the industry to reach out to their members. I already put this at ECHO on the communications agenda for the next weeks, that we send out an article about this on our newsletter. Is there something specific we should focus on when we do things like that from your point of view?
I can point you at a couple of web pages we've created. One is to for an administrator to look at to answer the question, well, how do I know if I'm using the old key or not? So if for popular software, it walks you through how to look in your configuration. And then we have another page that's, okay, so I'm using the old key. How do I get the new key and configure it properly? So we have those two resources. They're not designed for the average person. They're designed for somebody who runs a resolver. But I could certainly point you at those as a starting point. If you would want, I can to write an article for you, or we'd be happy to do that as well if that would help.
Just on that point, I think that would be helpful because we could certainly draw attention to that, and we should put some links on our website. That's a follow up probably for me to follow up with Christian with your help, Lars, to put some links in, and also if we can point them towards an article, that would also be helpful. Well, and we can send out a round robin to our members to try and draw attention to this as well. Andy.
Yeah, thank you, Andy Pitts, for the record. I just wonder with that, the change in the graph there where it suddenly goes up fairly steep, is there any particular reason you found for that?
Yes. Could I ask you to go back, back a slide or two? Keep going, please. There we go. Forward again, please. No, I'm sorry. The other direction, please. One more, I think. That's it. Yes. That was it. Yes. So the Unbound, which is a popular recursive resolver with DNSSEC support, they released a new version in the middle of January, and it was a fix for a relatively serious security vulnerability. So our hypothesis is that motivated people to upgrade, and so with it, the timing fits perfectly. So we're pretty confident that was Unbound.
Thank you, Sheet Vikar from Orange. I'll just repeat what I said during the CLUES meeting. I think I'd encourage all members to have a look at the list and search for the name of their company and see whether they're on that list. It was actually distributed on the ISPCP. Maybe that was an older version of that file.
Yes, there's an older version that I sent, but what I'm going to do is we're going to get a web page up that automates that's sorted by ASN so that we'll have a stable resource we can send people to, and you won't have to mail around huge files.
That would be brilliant. Two comments. I think there are two things that we at least as an ISBN operator we can do. The first one is quite easy. Would be to reach out to the operations of the DNS cache servers and double check with them whether they are on that list and see what's their position. That's generally speaking quite easy to do. The tedious part would be because I suspect that on the new version it's just an IP address and it doesn't mean that those that are involved are like the mainstream big stuck resolvers. It's just an IP address. It could be anyone using that IP address for a DNS resolver anywhere. So the tedious part would be to go down the tree and possibly find out where that address lies and double check with that possibly person whether the PC who's hosting the see what I mean right, yeah. And that's a bit tedious. We're not quite sure whether that's useful. We can try and do that on a few cases, but I'm not sure we can do that for the whole part. But yes, yeah, certainly for the first part, that's something we can do as an ISP. And I'm not going to speak for the associations here, but I'm sure we can do that. More broadly, at least within the European operators, both mobile and fixed, that'd be great.
Thanks, Philip. Please.
Yeah, Tamar Gavrichenko, once again for the record. Short question. So, looking at this slide, it's slightly different from the one you've presented at ORC, and it's different in that on ORC the idea about unbound anchor was presented as a hypothesis. But so it's not confirmed?
I'm sorry. What was different? I was pretty sure it's the same slides, but there's so many slide decks flying around that.
To quote hypothesis, upgrade in placement, unbound anchor not to run again. So hypothesis. And here you this just reads upgrade in place means unbound anchor not run.
I have a recollection of making that change. Now that you say that, I don't remember. I wonder if I was just trying to. This might be an earlier version, and I looked at it and said, "Well, I'm not 100% sure." So I'll add the word. That's what I'm seeing. Remember? So I thought I'll add the word hypothesis. And so I have so many versions of so many slide decks flying around. So I apologize for that. It was
okay. Any final remarks? If not, we'll certainly follow up with you, Matt. Thank you for coming. And we will try and assist as requested. We'll also put the links in on our website, and we'll be in touch about links to an article if that's
okay.
Acceptable.
Yep, thank you very much. And I'll be in touch when I have that list published on a stable web page.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So we're in fear of catching up if I take a shortcut, which is to cut something out of the agenda or push it back till later, which I'm going to do, which is the thing listed as GNSO Council. There aren't any motions to be voted on at this council meeting, so I'm going to defer any discussion around council. Probably deal with it very quickly at the end of our meeting. And what I'd look to do is to move on for one more issue, and then we'll have a short break of 10 minutes. I would like everyone to come back after the break. But the next item is DNS abuse. Brian Schilling, I don't think can make it, but Lars, I think you were covering off this. Oh, you are here, Brian. Sorry. Lack of information. Welcome. Okay. So straight away, Brian, over to you. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. I apologize. I know it was on the agenda in Abu Dhabi, and I got double booked, so I apologize for being very late in meeting with you. I'm very much interested in hearing your feedback from your constituency. What I'll start off with is a description of the role. The consumer safeguards role, as I understand it, was generated out of community interest in having a department or someone within ICANN that was going to facilitate discussions across the community about addressing DNS abuse, and either doing so within ICANN's limited remit or having those discussions perhaps organically progress into looking at policies to address gaps within ICANN's remit to address DNS abuse. So in September of last year, we started off that process by hosting a webinar, and I can get that back to you, where we opened it up widely to the community, where we were asking questions. We produced a summary of the safeguards that we view coming from our articles of incorporation, the bylaws, policies, and the contracts that we have with registrars and registries. And we put that out for community input and feedback. Justifiably, there's this thing called GDPR that's got everybody really preoccupied. So we haven't had much discussion at all on safeguards yet within the ICANN community, other than a few one-offs here and there, but yet we haven't come to any type of topic of consensus or interest that would cut across the various constituencies and supporting groups. So that's kind of where we're at. I still have been doing some meetings with various members of the community at the different ICANN meetings and separate webinars. Recently started a project where I'm going back and looking at closed abuse complaints that have come into the compliance team. They've recently taken on an effort last fall where they're putting out quantitative metrics on the types of abuse that's coming into ICANN. And before, it used to just be a summary of abuse, but now they're breaking it into types of that are being alleged: spam, phishing, trademark, and IP infringement. But I'm taking that next step and looking beyond the numbers into the details to see what facts we can report out to the community to help, again, facilitate a discussion about abuse. So that's where we're at with the position. Certainly, I'm hoping after 26 May we get a little bit more movement on some issues, but would really welcome any thoughts that the ISPs have in respect to this role or areas of interest that you would like this position to look at.
Thanks, Brian. So the 26th of May date just was for...
Yes, okay.
I'm with you. Okay, of course, yeah. I try to obliterate every reference to that from my mind when we're not talking about it. Yeah. Okay, so let's open up for some comments. Anyone particularly want to offer any feedback now on DNS abuse to Brian? For a while, this has certainly been on our agenda to have this conversation to kick off, but we haven't actually covered this. We haven't focused this on our monthly calls either so far, which we need to do. We've had a lot of remarks from our colleagues in the CSG around this. I'm sure you're well aware of that, particularly from the IPC. But in terms of a specific focus from an ISP perspective, I think it's something that we need to do that we haven't done. Will Forrick, are you on remote participation here? I think he's online. Yeah. Let me... Oh, okay, it's just a totally separate issue. Sorry. Okay, all I can say, Brian, if no one has any comment here, is that we will... Oh, Philippe, please.
Thanks, Philippe Foucault. It's more of a question, really. It has been under my radar so far, too. But would you have, and my apologies if it's a candid question, but at least if it were only to initiate discussions within the ISBCP, would you have, you refer to metrics, initial elements that you would share, or even pointers where some material could be valuably shared within this this community? That would be helpful. Even, I hate to say definitions of it, because you refer to, and sometimes on these things it is tricky to define those. So if you have that would be useful.
Sure. Thanks, Philip. And I apologize. I think I forgot to start off in the beginning. This is Brian Schilling, although you did introduce me. So first, before I answer that question, if it does come on the radar, I'm happy to participate in any of your monthly calls, or if you want to have a more tailored discussion about something, happy to do that any point in time. But right now, to answer your question, Philip, under the compliance teams, monthly reports, they have a dashboard. And in August of 2017, they started putting more granularity to their reports. Prior to that, just off the top of my head, if they got 50 abuse reports in a month, it just said abuse 50. In August 2017, they totaled, so August 27, I think, was 66 total abuse reports. And then they started breaking that down by the abuse that's alleged in the complaint. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's actually what's happening, but it's what the complainant is alleging. And that is broken down into spam, farming, phishing, straight-out fraud, trademark, and copyright infringement. And further down on those monthly reports on their dashboard, it does give some definitions as to how they're categorizing that and breaking that down. But just in the past 5 months, the compliance team has received 353 categorized abuse complaints. Now, there's a lot more things that have come into the compliance team, but those are the number that we have concerning abuse.
So the issue is with those, some are going to be much closer to home for ISPs, to, for our attention, than others. Out of those 353, are there two or three categories that are overwhelmingly the focus for that? And if so, can you just say what they are?
I can't. I know there are. Unfortunately, I just came from the IPC, so I was prepared for them. And there were 18 trademark and copyright categorized abuse complaints. But it kind of varies. In some months, I do recall the numbers of spam complaints were higher versus and certainly some malware. But it does vary and fluctuate.
So that would probably be the sort of information that would help us focus down on that. So maybe what we should do is have a dialogue with you before we invite you on a call and ask you if you could come along with some of that information that particularly draws attention to the categories that primarily ISPs would feel that they would have some major concerns. That would really be helpful.
That'd be fantastic. I'd welcome that opportunity.
Okay. We'll certainly make sure that happens. Any final comments before we close? Well, thank you for coming, Brian. Appreciate that. And we will make sure that happens.
Great.
On our call. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
So we're at the stage now where I am going to break the meeting just for 10 minutes. So if I could just say, everyone, please be back by 20 past, and we'll roll on with the other agenda items from there. Three and a quarter hours is a long time to go without a break, so please return promptly. If I could ask everyone to take their seats, and we will pick up the meeting again. Thank you. Okay, can we get going again, please? I know from our previous association with RSAC, it's always really difficult to get time on their agenda, so I really appreciate Rod being with us. And I'll ask Rod to take us through where RSAC are with their issues currently, particularly drawing focus on the issues that are important to the ISPs. So, Rod, over to you. Thanks.
Thanks. Hello, everybody. I've met several of you, but I see other faces in the room that I'm not necessarily familiar with or may have just seen in the hall. So my name's Rod Rasmussen. I'm the new chair of the ESSEC. To my right here is Julie Hammer, who's the new vice chair. And behind us is Patrick Fulstrom, who is you will recognize him as the former chair. I brought him along as a subject matter expert on one of the issues and of one of our recent reports in case you have some deeper questions that I cannot answer. Wanted to just have a quick chat about things. We don't have a deck here, which probably would take way too much time anyways, about topics of interest that we're working on. Obviously, the big one for us, if you've been following along, we have this name collision analysis project, or NCAP, in response to the board's request that we take a look, a hard look at what actually is going on with name collisions, understanding the size scope, giving some thoughts on how to quantify that and quantify risks, as well as understanding root causes and then potential mitigation methods. It's a fairly ambitious amount of work to do and to do it right. I would say that members of this community in this room would be people we would want to try and work with, either as bringing in as people who are actually part of the work party, because one of the things we're doing, which is unprecedented for us, is having this be a much more open process. The board requested that for, I think, many reasons, which we don't need to get into. But the idea here, we're going to including people who may have data, maybe have interest in analysis capabilities, et cetera, to actually take part in the work. And that will be that we will give public readouts on that as we go through this. We expect this to take a couple years to get through those various stages, and we'll have a series of studies. But one thing I would definitely hope we could do is be able to work with some of your members to, through some vehicle, at least be able to get some access to data or at least summaries of information that would be of interest to understanding and categorizing some of the things that you're seeing on your networks that would be part of collision types of scenarios. So that's the big thing that we're doing. Currently, we have some current work open on some looking at Internet of Things, and in particular, we're looking at that and with respect to DDoS capabilities and the effects that may have on the DNS infrastructure, and then some potential ways, different ways of looking at mitigating that. We're also looking at who is rate limiting as part of a wider project we had around various access to resources of things related to GTLDs. And we also are unofficially, officially going to be looking at the KSK role as far as the current or plan that has been proposed to deal with that. We do have a couple of publications that have come out recently. One of those was SAC 100, which relates to that, and that we did a summary. What we did there was basically a summary of earlier advice and kind of put that all together in one place. And then SAC 99, which was something else you'd asked about, which was one of the IDN ones, which is why I brought Patrick along, so you can actually talk to that a lot better. So those are kind of the current topics really quickly of what we're doing, and I'd really like to get anything from you on what your interests are and hearing more about what we're doing, and then any other questions about SSEC in general, I'd be happy to have.
Thanks, Rod. Mark?
Just a really easy question about name collision, Russ. Patrick's laughing because all the questions about name collision are easy. So in terms of the scope of what SSEC is going to do, how is it different from what the JAS report was? What was that 4 years ago?
So I think if you take a look at and we have by the way, I failed to mention it, but if you didn't know, we have an actual project plan proposal up for public comment already. So you can go to the standard ICANN public comments page and take a look at that, where we do talk about that. I think we're trying to do, well, we have the benefit of a couple things. One is time, and there have actually been we'll call them experiments that we were only anticipating prior to the rollout of the new TLDs. So there may be a wealth of data to be found there, and people who have actually stood these things up and have seen what's been going on. Another is that we've had some maturity in some of the instrumentation and things that didn't exist at the time. And then there's also access to, we're looking to try to broaden the scope a bit and get resolver data and work, people with networks trying to get at least large, like corporate, university, other kinds of networks like that. The other thing we're looking at doing is setting up test lab type of situation to actually drill down on root causes and try and basically recreate the conditions so we can understand it, and then that which could drive potential mitigation methodologies as well. So I think we've got a broader remit around what to do here. If you take a look at the board resolution, they ask a lot of questions. So I think that's kind of the difference. But there's a lot of that work. Part of one of our first things to do is kind of go back and take a look at their stuff and other things that have been done by others in the same space and kind of bring that together. Got it?
Yeah. I had a similar view on that because I remember in the past, in this community, there was a lot of angst about potential name collisions. And even when we had discussions with the board, they seemed very reluctant to engage with us in a way that was really meaningful and take this on. And I know from previous dealings with Patrick, he's certainly beaten me up a few times and said, we only do things that you ask us to do. And it's always then trying to get a focus on what you think is important and get that on your agenda. So I understand all the dynamics of that. But similar to Mark's remark, I was really surprised when I saw there'd been that, what I consider to be quite a time lag. And now all of a sudden it seems that we're back on. It's good news that that's happened, but I'm still a little bit mystified, I must admit, as to why there was such a time lag before we went down that path. Maybe you can't throw any more light on that, but it just seemed a surprising thing when I found that was the case.
And I'll refer back to the comments Dave Conrad made yesterday in the public session we had on the cross-community session. There were questions asked, I'm not sure of who, that wasn't us, and answers were not forthcoming. And I don't remember exactly where he was pointing the finger, but he did talk about that because the same question came up yesterday. From our perspective, it's been, you know, we'd said quite a bit prior to the original rounds. We hadn't really looked at saying anything else until the board came along and said, part of it too is just the pressure from figuring out Home Corp and Mail. I mean, frankly, that was sitting there, and the board has taken their own separate action, obviously, on the, you know, the quote unquote business side of that. But, you know, in order to clean that issue up, I think that was a catalyst as well.
Okay, thanks, Philippe.
Thank you. Philippe Foucault from Orange. Yes, a question and a comment, if I may. Are you going to try and learn from that experience of the last round, beyond the few cases that you mentioned, the comment being the following, we were one of those, we are in the unusual situation of being both TLD operator through a partnership and being a source of collisions through our mobile connectivity machine-to-machine devices. And we continue monitoring this. As an experience, through the controlled interruption period, we were waiting for Judgment Day, and eventually it was more like the bridges of Manicum County, if you see what I mean. It was just nothing happened. A message from the CTO to have 24/7 support during that period, and basically all of this was due caution, but for nothing. So I was, what sort of feedback would you expect from people like us who would continue that monitoring and had to go through that hassle?
When you say the monitoring, which side of the equation are you talking about the monitoring on?
Both.
Both, okay.
Both the client and the server.
We
do both.
Yeah, and I think that, and I'm not sure how much you were engaged with Jazz or anybody else that was looking at that the prior bit, but I mean, those are the kinds of things where we'd want to go to two things. One would be, any historical data that you collected during periods where there may have been something that was going on. I obviously don't know what you may have kept or not. Any analysis done. Those are actually really useful inputs, even if you quote unquote didn't see anything happen. That lack of something happening is actually one of the things we need to identify as well. And then also just things that are currently going on network. As far as potentialities for understanding why there are things leaking into the ecosystem that would basically be considered a collision capable type of a thing. It's really until we start getting into the projects and scoping out where all the possible data sources may be and things like that, we're actually going to be putting that kind of stuff out for comment and having this open discussion group around that. So one of the things we're standing up is a discussion group too, so that people with information and experience can actually chime in and say, yeah, that's not really an issue. You can kind of, here's what we saw. That's extremely valuable because it keeps us from wasting time on something that may not be there.
thank you. That's very useful. I'd be glad to take part, and it would certainly also be useful for the potentially the next round and make sure that people would not replicate the sort of, I wouldn't call that mistakes, but call for caution that and procedures we had to put in place, which right. proved unnecessary from an ISP's perspective.
Thanks. Could I ask you to say a little bit more about, you mentioned IoT and DDoS, a little bit more about that piece of work, because I wasn't aware that was taking place. I don't know. What the other?
Yeah, and well, we started out, we're getting a lot of requests from the ICANN community to talk about IoT, because it's a thing. Right. And so we said, well, what is there to say that hasn't been said already by, you know, 30 different other commissions or more like 300 other organizations are looking at it. So we've tried to, and where can we add some value in this space? Cause it, what are the gaps that are unique to the ICANN world? And or where we might have some different insight. So that was kind of the catalyst for starting, you know, taking a look at this, and we did a cataloging of that. What we've evolved to, and there's no guarantee this work will actually go you know, be pushed out as a work product, because we're still taking a look at this. Does it make sense to do? Because if we're not adding something new to the conversation, we'll just shut down the work party and not finish. We've done that before on other topic areas, but what we've kind of concentrated on is there's this interaction, especially if you take a look at Mirai and a couple of these other large-scale DDoS attacks done by these IoT botnets, where the DNS is obviously highly affected. There are people concerned about the scale that we're starting to see. And so there also may be some capabilities that ICANN or the ICANN community, members of the ICANN community, can be part of in order to have understand how to prevent them better, I mean, share information around that kind of thing, and also respond during times of duress, so to speak. So, and we may actually be coming to folks like yourselves who actually have to deal with this stuff across the networks for some thoughts on that. But we do have people with, you know, in the same vein on the work party itself. So, that's the kind of thing where we may do a little outreach on and see if does this make sense, kind of thing.
I'm sure that there would be some interest in that from this community. Philip.
Thank you, Philippe Foucault. Just to build up on that, and are you, maybe you said that, but I missed it. Are you interested in DNS as a target or as a source of DDoS, or both?
Both. And when source is more the reflective side, right? Because you don't have too many IoT DNS-only devices out there. Yeah.
Okay. Any further issues on any of the points that Rod raised? I realise we're letting Patrick off the hook here. It doesn't seem right, but okay. one ask before you go, Rod.
Sure.
We always struggle to get scheduling with you, and certainly with the focus now on, particularly on name collisions, IoT, I would ask that we try and schedule a slot for you when we go to Panama. So just an early request, maybe you can take that into account. I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, and I'd really like to... go ahead. I was just going to respond to that, if that's right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and we have to figure out a way to get around.
After.
Yeah, we got to figure out a way to get around, because we have a little bit more flexibility, because we have our admin committee meeting and over the weekends and things like that. But the Tuesday is tough, and that's the.
Yeah, I know.
But we really actually, given what we're going to be doing with our work party, we might be able to do something that with the NCAP work party, since that's so relevant to what you're doing. So we'll get creative on that. But we really want to engage with your group.
Excellent.
Here, for sure.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Fiona.
Thanks a lot, Tony. Just a quick one, Ron. As you're doing the work on the DDoS, are you documenting it? Is there somewhere where we can find it? Or do we give you some more time to finish what you're working on before we can have some material to look at and to possibly share with other ISPs or something like that?
Okay, so just it's the standard ESSEC modus operandi for doing this stuff is we do everything internal and then publish a document. We may, during that process, reach out to individual experts to get opinions. Now Patrick wants to talk. So through various processes, we typically don't publicly publish drafts and things like that. There could be an opportunity, though, depending on how this work party goes, to do something on a you know, quote unquote non-disclosure basis. Although we're not, you know, not an NDA, but I mean basically a something that we could share with some of your members to get feedback on. That's I believe been done before, and Patrick can probably fill me in on that.
Thank you, Patrick Feldstrom. I would like to point at a different work item that is going on in the community regarding Internet of Things that we are synchronizing with, and that is that RIPE have in its community a working group on Internet of Things. And we in ESSEC, we are coordinating with that group. So the RIPE working group compared to us is a public discussion.
Okay. Thank you. And we really appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure. Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. So waiting very patiently in the back, I think, was been Chris. So, Chris, welcome. Please come and talk to us about the North American engagement strategy. I know there are other people here who are involved in that, Jen being one person, and Mark being another.
Are you okay for time?
So we've always got time for you, Chris. Yep. So I will cut you off an appropriate time when you're overrunning, but feel free to.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tony. This is Chris Mondini. I have two hats. I've worked with a number of you already wearing my first hat, which is a global role for business engagement and helping businesses like, for example, ISPs and telcos become more involved in ICANN. I'm also, as you probably saw on Monday, the vice president for this region, which is North America, even though it doesn't feel very northern. But I'm always very grateful for your interest in engagement. So first, was there anything in particular, before I just start, is there any particular spin or aspect of it that you wanted to learn about?
From a constituency perspective, this is pretty new to some of our members, so I was keen for them to basically learn more about it and make sure that they have an awareness of what's going on. So anything along those lines would be useful.
So engagement defined is really about involving the people who are affected by your work and decisions in the work and the decision making. And so that is actually something that's outlined in ICANN's mission and commitments as well. And so there is a team within ICANN.org that works with you in the ICANN community to involve those stakeholders. Now, the next challenge is how do you define involvement? And there's really a range that can go anything from signing up for a newsletter and knowing what ICANN is to participating on a review team or drafting a public comment or being on a working group or serving in a role like you are. And so the ISPCP constituency, I think, especially is affected by this because I've spoken to organizations that have sometimes say, oh, ICANN, it's that body that's, you know, we're asking us to implement new systems or figure, you know, universal acceptance or name collision or all these things that we hadn't really, we see them as investments and expenses and costs and yet also you're the organizations that have the help desks who get the calls when something isn't working. So engagement, I think, is particularly relevant to this group. In the North America context, as compared to my counterparts in the different regions, engagement is somewhat different. In other regions, there's a lot more just letting stakeholders who don't know or know that there's an openness to ICANN get involved. In North America, because the internet and ICANN both grew up in North America, because the language constraints are relatively, and the cultural constraints are relatively lower, it hasn't required sort of the building something from the bottom up or even asking stakeholders what they need. And similarly, the community in North America is a little less coherent before it gets to ICANN. So as I'm charged with being balanced across stakeholder categories, sort of business, technical community, governments at large, civil society, and so forth. And whereas some of the parts of the world that you come from, those communities all talk to each other as part of sort of an internet community in a smaller geography before they get here, I often experience North Americans at the ICANN microphone sort of debating their issues in front of ICANN before they've, whereas sometimes it's helpful if they talk to each other before they get here. Just what we do in terms of activities, we do some of the usual stuff like the newsletters and the webinars and the kind of comms, social media, all of that stuff. We've started doing more post-ICANN meeting readouts, which is an idea that I pinched from our Asia-Pacific colleagues. So in Asia-Pacific, if you can imagine, there are so many different languages. Like Japan is a very good example. They'll send like two people to an ICANN meeting, and then a couple of weeks after the ICANN meeting in Japan, they'll have the whole internet community of Japan come and hear from those two people. That'll go through everything that happened at ICANN. It applies in a way to other regions too, because what we'll do is partner with any organization that wants to do one, working alongside a community member. We'll give a readout of sort of like five or six headlines, hopefully for a sort of stakeholder diverse group, and it's a safe space where they can sort of debate and ask questions and learn in a way that it's not being transcribed, it's not going to be on a record, and so people who are sort of experienced in the community see where there might be talent in that room, and people who are emerging talent and getting involved are feeling comfortable about learning about the sort of the intricacies of policy. We're trying to do some structured things with academic institutions where students and things like technology policy might get academic credit for actually performing a role that a PDP working group might request or your community might need help on. And then finally, the initiative that Jen and Mark and others have been helpful with is I kind of, in a sort of a top, not in a very bottom-up way, put together an advisory group across North America. And this really, it was spurred on by At Large and Neuralo. And I tease them. I say it's very easy to get At Large people to turn up to give their opinion on something. But in North America, I also have to say the other stakeholder groups and categories across ESSO and AC and constituency structures are very busy on their stuff. And I would like to get a balanced point of view. So working with a bunch of you, I identified people in each sort of either SOAC stakeholder group or constituency, put a small group together, it's about 20 people across North America, and I'm trying to take as little of their time as possible to get input about how engagement might work. They can answer a survey, they can attend a webinar, they can come to a lunch tomorrow on Wednesday at noon here and have a sandwich. And I just have asked three specific questions about North America. One is about converting passive followers who are now aware of ICANN and interested and may have learned enough to become more active in signing up, becoming pen holders, becoming discussion leaders, becoming active in those ways I discussed earlier. Improving the experience for remote participation, because I think we're in an era where making it meaningful and rewarding somehow for people to believe that participation in ICANN does not require going to every ICANN meeting. And then thirdly, in North America, we have a couple of geographic locations where there are a lot of stakeholders that are very active and have a community, and I'd like to get to other pockets across the region. North America is really, I have the easiest job because it's really just two countries and their territories. It's not, 47 countries and multiple languages. So I posed those questions. I tried to be very focused and try to get some feedback. We've surfaced some great ideas on everything from remote tools that we could improve upon to really something that we've always struggled with, which is identifying what are the stakes and why should you care, and why should you, the person who's turned up for something, have any motivation to get more involved? The story that we tell. And of course, we're trying to measure all of it. Some things are easy to measure, like how many people you get through the door, how many people read your articles in a newsletter. But measuring, you can even measure who signs up for a working group, but you can't really measure how they contribute or how much faster policy emerges out the other side. These are things that we're always struggling with. And then finally, I just want to say, again, many of you in this group I've worked with and on a very stakeholder-led, ideally, my role is to support your efforts, but you're very busy on the policy. So when you do have initiatives or ideas, I really want to go where your ideas are. And again, in the business engagement role, we've done that. We've done that successfully around the world, I think, in a couple of instances. If you know of places where stakeholders gather in North America that are ISPs or telcos and we aren't there, whether to talk about things like KSK or name collision or just ICANN policy, we will go there on your suggestion. And then finally, at some point in your upcoming discussions on engagement, do give some thought not only to Panama, which I'm sure you're thinking about, but also Barcelona. There's quite an opportunity there to do something effective, I think, and the business constituency and also is interested, and you could even do it as a commercial stakeholder group. I would be very happy to support any programming you want to do there. That's off the topic of North America, but I want to plant that for whenever you have time to discuss it.
Okay, that's very helpful. Jen or Mark, anything you want to add from that perspective? Or are you going to remain passive? No, you're not, Mark. I wouldn't have expected you to. Please, go ahead.
I'm just channeling Jen. Jen and I participated in the webinar. I thought it was really interesting. There were I was actually in a car crossing Texas when I was on it, but it was another person on the call that had the gunfire in the background, as I remember. It was not me. I think what was interesting was that what we had on the call was a pretty diverse community of people, and yet there were lots of positive ideas. I think that the three one of the things that's been really helpful about this is to have three very focused questions to respond to. Right, and so you're not responding to a survey of 50 questions. That just wouldn't have gotten you what you wanted, and you would have gotten less participation. I think what's interesting is that as someone who lives in between the coasts, the ideas that came up were pretty creative in terms of solving the second and third problem, right? Not so much the first. I didn't feel like we made a lot of progress on the first. But the second and third of those problems, I think there is real possibilities. And I was Jen and I were reflecting after the call, which actually shows something, right? Maybe the question about remote participation is not just a North American question. In fact, our reflection on this was, well, I gave that answer about, boy, one of the things that would make remote participation better was better remote participation tools. And then I thought, well, gee, that's cool, and that's cool to say that in the context of North America. And my joke was about Adobe Connect, which I hate, but that's a general, that's an engage, that's a step up. I mean, that's an engagement issue in general. So I think, I guess, from the ISP's point of view, I think we've seen some creative suggestions that came out of our community, but also came out of others as well. I was really intrigued by the kinds of suggestions you were getting. And they weren't parochial. They weren't targeted at particular constituencies or interest groups. I thought that was really useful, too. So I thought you got good input, and I know that I'm speaking for Jen here, that we'll be at lunch tomorrow to contribute some more. So I think it's really been an interesting effort.
Thanks. Jen?
You know, the only thing I'd add to what were Mark's comments fully, I won't take credit, would be, you know, Tony actually had, Harris had some ideas when we had an internal discussion just about, and I don't want to take, you know, steal your thunder if you want to mention any of it, but sort of regional organizations that, you know, a certain focus. And I can't remember the two organizations you mentioned in D.C. right now. But what I found interesting about that point was that I still think there is, we definitely need to do more in the middle for sure. But I still think that there are missed opportunities in the main hubs. And we can talk about this more tomorrow or two. But, you know, internet governance is a subset of my portfolio. In terms of my broader role, and there are so many places, you know, so many times I'm around DC at various events where I think ICANN should be here, or these people would be interested in what ICANN is doing. And I think some of that could go to, you know, what you were saying too, Tony, in terms of looking at different organizations. But we'll talk tomorrow, so I'm going to stop talking.
Okay.
Chris, do you want me to?
If you want to
just briefly, thanks for both of the comments. One of the reasons I wanted to pull this variety of the group across the community is to break, like, each SOAC kind of thinks that they have, some of them have common issues. Others, you know, the GAC or the SAC, they'll say, oh, we don't need people, or we don't, you know, but there are things that can be helpful. When you're thinking about your audience, or thinking about getting your word out, or thinking about how an ESSEC publication gets distributed, which is a thing I still haven't gotten the ESSEC to think about. But I get a lot of people that say, oh, I just want to sign up for the, all I need is when they publish something, how can I get that? There isn't a mechanism actually yet. And on your point, Jen, about associations and partners, especially for business engagement, business associations are key, right? Because we can't talk to everybody. So, and in a way, I mean, I once spoke to somebody who was from an ISP who said, oh, I follow everything that's at ICANN, and then I have an informal phone call quarterly where we talk about ICANN stuff with other ISPs. He was in a policy. I said, that's the ISP constituency. Like, so what, you know, don't, so your point about being at an event thinking ICANN should be there, well, guess what? You're also ICANN. So, you know, to amplify and put your hand up and say, you know, let me connect you to the source of information, or let me tell you, I think, keep ICANN in mind for the next gathering. But also, again, to that point, to tell us, and whether it's you or us together, we'll try to get there and get it covered. So thank you very much again. I always appreciate the cooperation, and thanks for your ideas.
Thanks, and we enjoy working with you, so thanks for your efforts, Chris. Okay, we're going to stay on a similar sort of theme now, and I'm juggling with the agenda, but whilst we've talked about engagement, one of the things we've got on our agenda is the community consultation on the fellowship programme. So, Esteban, this is your moment of fame, if you could help us. Yes,
thank you, Tony, Esteban Lescano, for the record. I have a presentation. I don't know if you have it. I think that is a community consultation on fellowship program, something like that. No. Sorry, I sent to Tony. Tony, you sent to him or not? Ah, okay. No, I have it. If not, I can send to you, Lars.
It appears.
Yes, it's Fellowship Community Consultation, the name of the...
I'm aware that we don't seem to have anyone on...
Can I send to you, Lars?
Yes, sure.
Okay. I'm remote. We seem to have lost Wolf, so if that...
No, don't worry.
Okay.
Maybe Tony, if you want, we can go with another point of the agenda, and
okay, there's something we can rattle off pretty quickly, because I don't think there's anything we've got to debate at length, and that is just to make sure we turn to our councillors, Tony and Philip, really just to ask you if there's anything you particularly want to draw attention to with regards to the GNSO council meeting that will take place here. So anything you feel that you should raise? Yes. Whoever.
Philippe Foucault here.
Normally we go through the motions. I don't believe there are any motions.
No motions.
So anything particularly you just want to comment on?
The items for discussions are the FY19 paper that will be sent by council. The other things are for discussion, essentially. I'm not sure we want to go into the detail of that. There are three other items for discussion. The cross-community engagement group on internet governance, the input on the fellowship program that we've just discussed, and the inter-registrar transfer policy. On the finance, although it's not for the council meeting, I would encourage people on the FY19 issue. Encourage people to have a look at the transcript of the GNSO CCNSO council meeting. I think that was yesterday, was it? And in that document, I believe it's on. I can send it to the list. Our CCNSO colleagues refer to rejection action petition, which might be sent from within that community as part of the empowered community as a whole. It's in the transcript, so it is possible that we see that in the next few weeks. I thought that we'd mention that.
That is an important point. I don't. You mentioned it's in the transcript, but I don't know whether, Mark, you were there as well, whether there's another quick layer of detail on that. Why that came about would be helpful to people who weren't there. That was all. The essence of why that situation has occurred.
Well, it depends on which situation you mean.
The possible submission of...
So that would be a part of the organization that is so unhappy with the budget that they took that action.
Mm. There was no substantive discussion at that meeting.
No, in fact, the CCNSO is very careful to say that they had only heard discussions of that and that there was no formal, there was nothing happening yet.
Okay, that's all I wanted to clarify. Okay, thanks for that. And we're going to have a short item on budget for the ISPCPs in a moment. But Esteban, over to you.
Yes, Esteban Lescano for the record. Well, now the the fellowship program is under a community consultation process, which idea is to review the program. And please, the next one. The idea is, to review the program after 10 years. No, this program began in 2007, and the idea is to review and also to plan the for the next decade, thinking in a long term sustainability. Also to dotate the program of greater accountability and transparency, and is also based, one of the inputs of the community consultation was a 10-year survey that was made to all the ICANN fellows in June 17. And also that is connected with the previous point of the agenda is connected with the budget restriction that the organization is facing. Next, please. Perfect. Yes, this consultation is structured in a questionnaire that has 7 topics and 19 questions. The titles of these topics were program goals and ambitions, assessment on program impact on AC and CO group, selection processes, program size, program structure, information available on program, general questions. And there is an email to send the answers to this questionnaire, and which is very important that we have a deadline that is at the end of this month. Really the previous day on Friday, no? The 30 of March. As maybe I don't know if everybody is or know knows about this program. That's why I just I want to provide a brief view of the program. This program was designated as a tool to bring new people to ICANN, mainly from underrepresented and communities and underserved areas. This fellowship consists that ICANN finance these newcomers and participants with a stipend, economic class airfare, and hotel accommodation for every ICANN meeting. The meeting is prepared by fellows in previous sessions through a coaching process and through ICANN Learn platform. And for example, since Abu Dhabi meeting, there is an ICANN Learn course about ISPCP, okay, that was designed Osama and me, we were working on that, and we have this program that is available for newcomers and fellows. During the meeting, the fellowship consists in a capacity building program with sessions, not many sessions, with interviews with the ASO AC leadership, trying to explain and to get the people involved in the multi-stakeholder model and explain the bottom-up process for policy making. The expectation is that the once you finish your fellowship, well, you have to present the report, but the idea is to engage with the community, no? Next. The selection criteria, well, there is an independent committee, and there is many criteria to select the fellows that is focus on diversity in gender, sector, experience, expertise, members of an underrepresented or underserved community, and who needs the financial support. And the experience and the reference is also important for each applicant. Yeah, well, if you would take a look to the whole program in those 10 years, well, for example, actually there is 180 fellows per year, but for example, for next year, as this budget restriction applies, there is a reduction to in 50% to 90 fellows. In the total of 10 years, 640 fellows were financing by this program. And 133 countries were represented. No? These two paragraphs are quotes from the consultation that states, many ICANN fellows are active participants in the ICANN community, serving in a number of leadership positions across ICANN community structure as members of the ICANN board, for example, Lito Ibarra and Leon Sanchez, and the ICANN organization. The fellowship program has been successful in bringing new people into ICANN. There is a potential for it to be instrumental to helping ICANN achieve a greater diversity by supporting participation from those countries and sectors with little to no participation. It's important to take into account that the focus of the fellowship is these people that comes from region like my region, Latin America, that is not easy to get engaged with ICANN, and it's not easy to get the financial support for participating. Next, please. Well, just some figures about the fellowship program. Those are in the consultation process. For example, the sector represented. You can see that civil society is at the head, but also, well, the private sector, the domain and industry, in the case of the private sector, is 11% of the total of the fellows. If you split by region, for example, it's very important you can see all the underserved areas, like Africa, 20%, Asia, 13%, no, Eastern Europe and Central Asia, 7%, and for example, Latin America and the Caribbean, 25%. No? North America, just 1%. And here it's interesting because there was a change since last meeting in Abu Dhabi, that now there is a program of tribal ambassadors, and the people coming from North America is engaged in this kind of program, that the idea is to also to bring the first people to the ICANN ecosystem. Well, in gender diversity, we have a problem, no? But it's still increasing, but also we can say that there is the difference, but the selection committee, when choose the different participants for the fellowship, they try to balance the gender. And that is very interesting because it's, okay, what happened with the fellows? O sea, which are the communities who receive the benefit of the fellowship program, because the former fellows are now engaged in those communities. Well, it's true that they are at large is the most the community that most more of the people goes there, and also the non-commercial stakeholder group. But for us it's also important because you can see that in the for example in the commercial stakeholder group receive a 6%. Yeah, and in my personal view, I think that is because it's it's more common that the person who come from an ONG or a non-for-profit organization is willing to get, for example, a fellowship or a scholarship that the person who come from a government or from a company. No, that is there is a different mindset. No, the same with academia. The people from academia or the people coming from non-for-profit organization are more. It's usual to get financial support for this kind of programs. No? Next. Well, which are the next steps? Well, we have to finish we have to answer all the questionnaire. I have a first draft, but I want to listen to you to get some guidance and some ideas. Then once I finish the draft of this answer, I will socialize in the ISP public list, and the idea is to send our final answers before the deadline.
Thank you for that. Thank you for the presentation. And I know from being chair for a number of years, I used to go along and meet the fellows first thing in the morning, and you did not want to go in there when you were asleep, because the level of questioning was really good. And of all the fellowship programs I've ever seen, this for me was always the best, without any doubt. I think ICANN did a really excellent job. And I know from talking to the fellows, yourself included and others, that they work you really hard. I mean, it really is demanding to be on that course. But at the end of the day, it really does have a really positive impact. And I certainly have got an awful lot of time for that and would like to support that. I'm really pleased that you've taken the lead in drafting something on behalf of the constituency. I'm sure you're working with Osama and others on that. And it's a great way to go to socialise that. Just a question on that before I turn over to Tony. Mark, do we also have the support from the document drafting person at the moment, or is that?
I'm so sorry that's the funding for that has run out.
Okay, which is a great shame. Well, we could have helped you a little bit more. But certainly, if you could produce that initial draft and circulate it, I'd really urge people to chip in and comment on that and support it, because this is a really worthwhile activity. Tony.
Yes, Esteban, if I interpret correctly, you're also looking for things to suggest for the improvement of the program, or
yes,
how to handle it since you're going to have less budget, right?
Yes, but all, I think that we are talking about the future of ICANN. This is a 10-year plan for the fellowship program,
mm-hmm.
and that's why it's very useful to get also recommendations or proposal. I think that some of the questions are oriented in that way.
Well, I think I've said this in the past, but I'll repeat it. I think if you're going to have less money, spending getting all those people from civil society, individuals, does not scale as much as if you at least you targeted people who are in heading organizations. I'm talking of chambers of commerce, not the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but small chambers of commerce in developing countries and NGOs who have large memberships. Because if you bring the leader of one of those organizations, when he goes back, he can scale whatever he's taken away from ICANN to an awful lot of people. Whereas if he's an individual, his circle of contacts and let's say of sharing his experience is much smaller. So, and I didn't see in the division of where you pointed out private sector and the different participant segments, let's say, in the fellowship program, I didn't see organizations or NGOs, for example. And perhaps a suggestion might be made that part of the effort in bringing people in could be directed at having at organizations more than individuals. But that's just something I thought of. Okay.
Just on that point, Esteban, when you pull together the response back, I think we could make the point that we would like to try and see it engineered in a way where there was more equality across the various sectors of ICANN from the people that are brought in. I think that would be a positive comment. Yes, any other?
Perfect.
Any other comments on that?
Oh,
I've been trying to raise Wolf Ulrich, so... Wolf Ulrich, are you there?
Hi, it's Wolf Ulrich speaking. Can you
okay,
hear
me? Okay, I tried to entice him to...
Hi.
Wolf Ulrich? Are you with us?
Are you with
us? Yes. You're with us many times with that echo. But, yeah, please, go ahead.
Is that working?
It's good. It's good.
Okay, thank you. I was on mute before, though, and I couldn't speak. But, you know, nevertheless, that was a very interesting presentation. I have one question, you know, also with regards to the budget cut. You know, this is a 50% cut. Was that decided by any reason to do it by 50%? Do you know that? Or does it...
Yes, I understand. The data of the 50%, Esteban Lescano for the record, the data of the 50% appears on the public consultation. The public consultation states that for fiscal year 18 was a number, and for the fiscal year, the next fiscal year is just a reduction of 50%. Okay, in the amount of participants. Okay, in money is not because every ICANN meeting has a different budget, and it depends on well the area and the cost of transportation, accommodation, and so on.
Well, Farek, it may be similar to some of the other comments that Jurgen's made a number of times across various things here, and he always explains it as casting the first stone, making some proposal that is there for people to comment on. So I think this falls into that category probably as well. But it's important we go back on this.
Thanks. Just an additional question is because of the question of the segmentation of applicants or those people who are. Selected from for this program, there may be more people coming from the non-commercial side and the ALEC side as applying for this. I would be interested to know how many people and from which sector have been. Rejected, have not been admitted, to participate in these programs, because that makes it. There's a question whether we should, for example, advertise in the future in our sector for this program anymore in order to attract people to apply for that. That's it. Thank you.
That's a really good point, Wolf Ulrich, and we should include that comment in our response, raise that question. Thank you. We've been talking...
To close the point that in my personal case, I was a fellow twice. I am now a coach for newcomers and fellows. Really, I am an evangelist about the program, because I think that is a powerful tool for people who wants to get engaged and to share with you that for me and in the experience of my partners and my partner fellows, no, is very important and real for sure is the opportunity to have a first encounter with the ICANN ecosystem.
Well, you described yourself as an evangelist. I describe you as a success story from the fellowship. So both are good. Thanks. We talked about budget, and one of the things I wanted to draw attention to is that the official cutoff for the budget comments was the 8th, and we did not make that as a constituency, but we have had some dialogue here with the budget team, and we're not the only ones who struggle with that being right before the ICANN meeting. So there is going to be a process for comments submitted after the cutoff. And I discussed this with Osvaldo. We're putting together a draft that we will basically circulate in the community or in the ISP community, and we'll be getting that off pretty quick. But Mark very kindly and helpfully drew together some slides that just pointed out a few major things on the budget. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. For one thing, we haven't got a lot of time. But I do think it's worthwhile just stepping through this really quickly, just for the background, that if people haven't looked at the FY19 budget, it would provide that background. So if we could do that pretty quickly, Mark, and just go through the main points on those slides, that would be useful.
This always happens to me with this set of slides. Just go through very quickly.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So once again, these are personal observations that I was making from my own notes about the it really wasn't intended as a contribution to the constituency, although I'm glad that it's helpful. So maybe I'll go to the next slide. That gets me two down. Thanks, Lars. So let me throw some numbers at you here. Back in the 2012 and 2013 budget rounds, the suggested growth for the new GTLD program, the suggested growth of the revenues as a result of deploying new GTLDs and the associated revenue growth with that, in those 2 years was budgeted at 22% a year. That turned out to be not very accurate, as we found out. One of the things that's been called into question this week is that the CCNSO has called into question the fiscal year 19 revenue estimates. So that's an interesting point. So that even though we know that 22% can't possibly be right, the current estimates are being called into question by people who know more than we do. One of the things that we all know here is that there's a projected drop in revenue. There's also a projected drop in expenses. And so the second line there is supposed to be expenses. And so what ICANN does here is it has a budget that basically takes the revenues as the top line and then tries to balance the budget with changes to the expenses. And I'll take the next slide here. Some detail on the increases here. The projection here is a very, very small increase, 4% in revenue, and there are some people who question that. Personnel costs, I want to share some other figures here that are very important. Personnel costs continue to go up in this budget, as does the headcount. Now, my notes on the headcount say that the budget that's being proposed grows by 25 FTE to 425 next year. So that's an addition of 25 in a budget where we're cutting. The other number here that I think is really interesting, or at least these, again, are in my notes, is that staff costs, personnel costs associated with staff comprise 56% of the budget, and professional services account for 17% of the budget. If you take those two together, staff and professional services, that accounts for 73% of the entire budget that is proposed in fiscal 19. So that's just a note there. And one of the things that is clearly done is that administration and operational costs receive the bulk of the cutting. That's 35% over the entire the budget. So, Lars, can I take you to the next one? Thanks. If you make comparisons here, this was just a comparison that a friend of mine dug up as we were going through the budget. If you make some comparisons here, you can actually take a look at increase in staff and professional costs compared to, for instance, inflation rates, and also other businesses in terms of headcount rates. And so that's just, this is a comparison ICANN against other metrics that you might use. Now, ICANN's a different organization. Let's all acknowledge the fact that, first of all, it's a nonprofit. Second of all, it has a global reach. It's a very unusual organization, but yet I thought those metrics were interesting to compare ICANN's increases. If you could go to the next line. Is this fast enough? So the major changes to come here. One of the things is that there are some this budget gets a lot of bad press, but there are a lot of good things in it. One of the things here is that there is extra money in this budget for research. There's additional personnel for the Open Data Initiative, and anyone who's been to ISP meeting with me at it knows that that's one of my favorite things, is trying to get data made public. There's a goal to do more DNS abuse analytics. Our friends in the contracted parties really find this very important, but our colleagues in the commercial stakeholder group also find this very important. So instead of actually being cut, this is an area in where there's actually money being set aside. And then one of the things that's interesting in this budget that I also think is a positive is a development of a think tank. For those of you who are old enough to remember Rob Beckstrom, I apologize to you. But if you remember Rod Beckstrom, there was this idea of developing a resource internal to ICANN that provided expertise in ways that the SOs and ACs couldn't do. The budget actually includes that and a small amount of money to support it. Maybe I could have you go to the next line. Thanks, Lars. I think many people have heard some of the things that are in the budget that have gotten bad press. I'll go over a couple of them. One of them is that the budget is almost dependent on revenues from the DNS market, right? So there is no attempt to diversify the revenue stream. Another thing is that constituency-supported travel remains even. So in this budget right now, or the way I read the budget, is that constituency travel is supported but not increased, which in the long term is a question mark. One of the things that has been important to the ISPs is that in this budget, crop is removed. Now, I've been told that crop has been moved into David Olive's budget, but of course it's not been earmarked. Us as an ISP community made a lot of use of CROP. We were effective at using it in terms of getting new members and doing outreach. It's actually a bad deal for the ISPs to remove CROP. One of the things to note, I don't have it on this slide, but I note it because I'm allowed to take two more minutes, is that ICANN has in the budget, you won't believe this, but no money for GDPR-related implementation in the enforcement division. I'll say that again. In fiscal 19, ICANN's included no money in the enforcement division for new GDPR-related work. I'm not a GDPR expert. I actually hate it. I think it's taken over this meeting in Puerto Rico. I abhor it. But in the budget, it seems to me that you have to know that this is going to be an important part of enforcement's activities in the next year. Let me see here. One of the things that has been a big controversy in this budget is support for travel. And what is not broken out in the budget is budget lines for constituency-supported travel, staff-supporting travel, board-supporting travel, and so forth. You can't tell whether those lines are increasing or decreasing. You have no way of making a judgment. And one of the things that you saw, the fellowship program, which, by the way, let me get in the line to support the fellowship program. I was a mentor to fellows two times and thought that program was great. We can have a conversation of whether we think that 50% cut is appropriate. I don't think that makes a significant enough a cut to actually do that. But there are other constituencies who have argued for right-sizing that program. And finally, what shall I say here? There is a significant expenditure For people who are technical in the community, one of the things that you see in this budget is a significant expenditure on IT infrastructure and security for internal activities inside of ICANN. So that's a sign for some of us where there's smoke, there might be fire. But that would be, I hope that was fast enough. Those were my slides.
That was perfect. Thank you. I've never used that word with you before, Mark.
No, and I never expect to hear it again.
It was great. And certainly the major points that you pull out there we'll be utilizing in our response that we'll get out. And we'll try to make it both positive and negative in terms of comments as well, which I think is the right way to go. So we'll circulate that pretty soon round for comments, because we need to get it in. Thank you. A couple of other quickie things. One of the items on our agenda, and so it doesn't take much discussion at the moment, is the board seat 14 election process. This has been an ongoing issue. This is where we elect our board representatives from this part of the community, along with the non-commercials. And we have to agree this as a house. And it's been ping-pong for a long time, and every time we have an intersessional, we discuss this, and we still struggle with it. I'm going to a meeting tomorrow morning, 7:30, where the leaders of the constituencies from our particular house are getting together to discuss this again. We haven't got that much disagreement left, but one of the key issues is whether you allow the non-com appointee appointed to your stakeholder group to vote in elections. We currently don't. The non-commercials have been very keen to make sure that that hasn't happened. In the contracted parties house, they do allow that. So that's a major difference. There was a document that was circulated prior to this meeting that Chantel kindly pulled together, looking at the two ways of doing things across the house, the two different approaches that have been discussed side by side, so you could see the differences. People should have had the opportunity to look at that. Wolf Ulrich, if you're there, is there anything you want to add on that item? Otherwise, I think it's a case of see where we are after the discussion tomorrow, where I'm fairly hopeful we'll finally conclude and agree a process to be used in future. But is there anything you wanted to add?
Hi, Tony. Thanks. Nothing else specifically. You will have also the meeting on Wednesday, I think, with tomorrow, yes, with the CPH, the contracted parties office.
That's right.
And that's also a point to discuss. Well, really, if, you know, the contracted parties house is really confirming that they include the NOMCOM appointee, I think, you know, that just should be not any problem. And we should go the same way, you know, on both houses as well, to nominate and vote for our board members. So that's the only thing I would like to say which should be discussed. All the other points are of lesser importance. I think we are on the right.
Okay, thank you for that, and I agree. I think it's unfair on the non-com appointees that if you go into one house, they do it one way, and you go into the other, and they do it differently. So fully agree with you, and that's where we'll be making that point tomorrow. And we will clarify that issue when we meet with the contracted parties house. So we're almost done. Sub-item under AOB was ISPCP elections. We are at the stage where we have to look ahead and discuss whether we've got any requirements for future elections, which we have. But that is on the agenda for the first call after this meeting. So we don't have to have any discussion around that now. That would be for the next call. So I'm just going to ask if anyone wants to raise any other items under AOB. And if that isn't the case, I can't see anybody indicating. Tony.
I'd just like to say we had a visitor today. He's gone from Canto, which is a Caribbean network telecommunications operations association. I was just looking through their website. We'll circulate later link to the list later. They have about 60 members in the U.S., and it's a huge organization. They've got all the islands in the Caribbean with service providers, cell phone providers. It's an enormous organization. I had no idea. And he sat very quietly there in a corner, but they applied for membership yesterday. So I think that's good news as far as outreach. And that was done by the ICANN staff member working in the Caribbean. What's his name? Albert Daniels, yeah, okay.
No, that's indeed very good news, Tony, and thanks for your help in bringing them on board. It's excellent news. Chris?
Just at the risk of embarrassing, Shabnil Samil is from Fiji. He's from Telecom Fiji. He sat through the entire meeting. He's very interested in the topics, asking me questions. I hope that you'll plan to spend some time with him answering questions, because this is a fellow who may be one of you someday. From Fiji, Telecom Fiji.
Again, that's a great example of the fellowship and the engagement strategy that's really working. So thank you for that, Chris, and welcome. We really welcome having that dialogue with you.
The second condition is that Fiji beats New Zealand in rugby, right?
I got there first, Mark.
Okay, so with that, I'd just like to thank everybody for participating in the meeting. Wish you all a safe journey home. Hope you enjoy the rest of the meeting. And we look forward to having you back in the fold in full health at our next meeting, Wolf Ulrich. And thank you for staying up late. So with that meeting closed, thank you very much.